Good morning, everyone. Let me go ahead and call the Thursday, September 13th, 2007 study session to order. The first item will be to review items on the agenda for our September 17th regular council meeting. I want to take a peek at the packet for those. Standard stuff on page 1, page 2 of liquor license applications.
Mayor?
I know 3F was out of compliance. Is that the same thing with 3D?
Yes. Both of these applications, the applicants have been notified that they can withdraw their applications until they've received their building permits. They've both submitted their plans early September, around the 4th of September, and we don't anticipate that they'll have their permits by Monday evening, but they wish to come and address the council on Monday evening.
Okay, so that's both fire and building safety, or a combination of those?
That's right.
Okay. Vice Mayor.
Thanks, Mayor.
Can you borrow those today?
Oh, it's brighter here than I thought. Hello. Sorry about that. There were three of them this time that...
Yes, but one of the permits was issued last week for Taquitos.
Okay, and my question is, it just seems like in all the years we've been doing this, I don't remember seeing these, and now we've had like four or five in the last couple of months.
You're correct.
Is there a reason that that's going on?
I don't know.
Can we kind of look into that and see if there's, you know, maybe we could ask them why they brought it forward like this, or if building safety or code or somebody, and see if there's been a change, something that's causing this to occur. I'm just interested.
I'll check into it for you.
Thank you.
Yes,
just to follow. Well, I'm curious if they're getting through with the liquor license and not having a permit. So are they getting through the state process? You go through the city, we recommend denial, which we have on the others, and then they get through the state with a liquor license anyway.
Mayor, Councilmember Summers, the one outstanding application that we have is for Rubio's.
Right.
That was denied by the council, and they're going to the state on the first week of October.
Okay. On 3E, you mentioned that they had their permit, so all their fire codes violations are handled or not?
3D Fox's Pizza does not have their permit yet. They have submitted their plans. They don't have their building permit
yet. Yeah, Taquitos, 3E, Echo.
Yes.
They're set?
Yes, they're all set.
So can we put them back on consent?
Yes.
They are?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm looking at my old one. They're off consent on mine. My apologies.
Rex.
How long after we issue a building permit and we vote on a liquor license does it take to get through the state?
It depends. It depends if there's any issues holding it up at the state level.
Yeah. Is it minimum? What's the minimum time?
Mayor, Councilmember Griswold, I don't know in terms of days. However, according to the state statute, if the municipality recommends approval and there's no objections, it can be approved by the state without setting a specific hearing date. So it
okay.
is accelerated. A hearing is required if an objection comes in either from the municipality or an individual.
So I was just wondering if they were trying to get this process done, because they get a building permit, they're usually ready to open the next day or the next week. If it takes another month to go to the state, they're trying to get so they don't have to open with no liquor license for a month or anything.
Councilmember Griswold, this particular restaurant, Fox's, is I think some Zushi's is new construction, and so they're not ready to open up yet.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Any other question on liquor license applications? All right, let's go over to page 3. Got one bingo application, and we get into contracts. Contracts are. That's it on page 3. Page 4, we get introduction of ordinances.
Mayor, if I may, on item 6E, that's the one that's been continued to rework the STIPs. We met with the applicants last week, and the ones you have before you now, staff and the applicant are in agreement with.
Okay, good. All right, that's page 4. Page 5, resolutions. Scott.
I'm currently doing some work with Arizona State University at the Polytechnic campus, so I'm going to have to request 7A be taken off and declare conflict.
I believe that's your first conflict, isn't it?
It is, and it took 15 months to find one, and
all right.
I found one.
Okay. Just couldn't get away from that place. You get your doctorate degree and want to go back and work, huh? All right. Anything else on page 5? Page 6, additional user resolutions. Vice Mayor.
Thank you, Mayor. I was glad to see that we've got some alley closures that are happening based on the neighbors requesting them. It's interesting to me, and I don't know how many other people already knew this, but to say that we could then cite people who were in the alley because it was no longer public property, it's private property, so we can cite them for trespassing. So that was interesting. But the question that I had is, it talked about the residents installing the gates or the whatever you're going to put in at the end of the alley. We had talked as a council about scholarshipping possibilities for that. Can I just get somebody to tell me where we are on that, and if these residents were informed of scholarship possibilities for helping to fund those gates? I think we were thinking gates were going to cost about $2,500 the last time I heard something about it. But looking around, I could see that. Can somebody else answer this? Craig, you're the man.
I'll help you.
Good morning, Mayor, Councilmember Walters. Neighborhood Services has kind of taken over that, the Pride grants, and there's some other things that the applicants can do, and I'll let Carrie answer those.
Mayor, Vice Mayor, we certainly encourage. We do have a pilot program that was established. It's in the Mesa Drive and Southern area. It's a very small area. That was the area that we're piloting, that we had some money that was set aside for those residents who come forward in that particular area, because that's where we initially saw a lot of illegal dumping and so forth. So we focused in on that area. We're working with the residents today to see if they'll come forward. Certainly we need 100% of the signatures. If that area, if we've gone through all those particular properties and they're not interested, we're going to be moving to different areas. But in the meantime, the fee continues to be, we don't have a fee anymore, so that program is citywide. In addition, we encourage those residents to go through the Pride, to obtain a Pride grant. We certainly encourage them to go through the United Way to obtain that.
And the United Way's maximum amount on the Pride grant used to be $500. Is that
changed? It's $2,500.
It is $2,500.
However, they're utilizing those funds quite frequently now, so it is, that fund is depleting.
Okay. Thank you. And so applications for that, they can get through Mesa United Way.
Exactly.
I used to know the number off the top of my head. Boy, when you become the former chair instead of the current chair, you can't remember the phone number anymore. But
Mesa United Way, yes.
Yeah,
that's who they contact. Yep.
Thank you. We're on page 6. Anything else? Try page 7. These are for action, different items. Glad to see 8C come through the way it was proposed. All right, page 8. Queens Park comes back. I think that's 8F, isn't it?
Yes, and Mayor, I passed out to you this morning the revised site plan for that. It's on your desk there. Two pages. One is the front one is the current new proposal that shows the 80-foot setback off of Woodland Avenue and the curve between the walls. Would also note that in addressing the movement of the buildings on the site, they decided to rearrange the buildings on the north end of the property. So when you compare the former site plan with the new one, you'll see the north end has buildings rearranged. All that still meets code, and we have no problems with that site plan.
Mayor. Okay. Scott.
I've been holding meetings quite frequently on this, trying to work out an agreement between the neighborhood and this project. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to find some common ground. The offer was on the table from the developer to push this back to 100 feet. If it would come back to a consent vote, legal protest removed. But there are more issues here than, as far as the neighborhood is concerned, about than distance. Some design issues and other things that are really about design review, not the zoning. So the legal protest will be staying on.
Okay. Will we be voting on the 80-foot or the 50-foot then if they are still having the legal protest in place? Or do they have the option of submitting either of these two?
Mayor, at this point, they have submitted this revised site plan. It's the one they are wanting you to give consideration to.
Even though they're not taking off the legal protest? They'll still bring them.
That was 100.
No, I thought we compromised up to 80, from 50 to 80.
They did that voluntarily.
Okay, all right. All right. Mike?
I have a question, John, on that. On the break on the fence, is that a view fence? Is that what that's depicting? You see where it comes in and out?
Mayor, Council Member Whalen, that's just some change in plane on the fence to give
okay,
a little
so it's offsetting
more
the face yes. somewhat? Okay.
All right. Vice Mayor.
John, in West Mesa, we're looking at some green space, open space, as you know, as part of thinking about parks, not just being current way we think of parks. And as I'm looking at this distance here, it seems to me that this is the kind of offset that we would think of as a green space, open space, if we were looking at this in West Mesa. Are there things that can occur in here in terms of it? I don't think this has been to design review yet, has it?
Yes, it has.
It has been to design review. Okay, well, maybe I need to talk to the applicant, because it seems to me that there are things that can happen in here that make it, you know, very desirable as a green space for the neighborhood. And I mean, if you look at it, to look at it more as almost a park area instead of just thinking of it as a landscape buffer. And I think that might be of assistance in terms of the visual appearance of the neighborhood. Okay, thank you.
Scott Claudium, part of that too is that the this agreement, I think, before us, if you read through, will tie these landscapes together. So they're continuous. What's grass on the one side, which I think we approved a few weeks ago, will be grass here, same types of plants. So you have a flow between the two.
May I respond?
Certainly.
Absolutely. And I agree with you, Council Member Summers. As a matter of fact, that's what made me think about it, that it's got that flow, and you're going to have the curve in the fence to give you, you know, more of that kind of linear park feel to it. And I think that that's one of those things that when the next person comes in for on the next piece over for that, we ought to talk about continuing that design to give it that linear park kind of a feel that can really give it a nice neighborhood appeal, as opposed to, you know, we're just setting back the industrial user from another user. And I think that there's an opportunity here for something really good.
Okay. That's page 8. Page 9. The 10.1. The information, I didn't have it in the packet. Is it coming out, or are we out on it?
Mayor, I believe you got that in your latest packet.
No.
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 Oh, you get it on Friday.
Okay. You want to give us a little information on what the issue is on that one? Do you know?
Yes, Mayor. I'll go ahead and start. And Kim, Leslie from the design review staff will come up in case I don't have enough details for you. You'll recall this was approved earlier this year, I believe. The applicant, as they worked on their final design, changed the shape of the building some and changed some of the design characteristics, thus requiring it to go back for administrative review because of the nature of the request and some of the changes. We took it to the design review board with a recommendation from staff for approval. The design review board looked at it because they had difficulties with the earlier submittal, comparing it to the overall design guidelines for the center, and had not recommended approval. They were uncomfortable approving this one, and so they denied it, and so now it's been appealed on to council for your consideration.
Was this the one that was kind of the off-the-box corporate, this is what a car dealership should look like for this type, or?
Mayor, yes, I think that's accurate.
Okay. And the appeal then would be for to allow them to make the changes. Okay. And we're going to get some site. What's the packet going to consist of when we get it?
Mayor, the packet will consist of black and white versions of these current elevations and of the current site plan that was slightly revised.
Okay. Now, I've done some conflicts on the other side. I assume because this is Dobson Road and it was tied in on the development agreement that I probably ought to declare a conflict on this one.
Mayor, that's going to be I do not believe that you have a legal conflict here because of the distance. However, for consistency purposes, you have in the past declared conflicts on all projects within the Riverview project to avoid an appearance of impropriety.
Yeah, let me. I'll do the same thing and turn that one over to the Vice Mayor when it comes up. I just noticed there was nothing in the packet.
Mayor, we got this just the last minute and wanted to help. The applicant was urgently trying to get this through. They are under construction. A lot of the effort is going to construction. John, and I don't know if you were mentioning this, we went through the same appeal for the other dealerships of this location. Is that correct?
Yes. We have had appeal, I believe, of the whole, which one? Kim can tell us for sure which ones it was.
In January, the three dealerships and auto maintenance project came through. So those were four projects. And the board gave conditions of approval to those projects. The applicant gave us a letter of appeal, requesting appeal, but we were able to work out a compromise before it came to council.
And I guess the question is how different is this request than what was worked out with the other dealerships? Because they're all going to be in the same area, correct?
That's correct. The staff's recommendation to the design review board was to approve these modifications because they were an improvement on what was already presented and conditionally approved. The board felt that it still didn't meet the original conditions of approval. That's why they denied it. So we're still recommending approval.
Okay, let me get some clarification here. They didn't approve the first one. The dealership, I know they were going to appeal. Then they went to their corporate folks, and the corporate folks said, no, we can work with this. They made a few changes. They came back, and there was a compromise reached. So we never saw that appeal.
Right. Mayor, or Vice Mayor, that's pretty close. Let me say it slightly differently. I believe the board approved it, but with some conditions that the applicant wasn't quite comfortable with.
Okay.
They brought in some modifications, however, that staff felt went far enough and did meet the conditions. All the board wasn't maybe quite sure they really met the conditions. Staff was satisfied, and so we took it on.
Would it be fair to say that if that had gone back to that board at that time, that they would not have approved it?
I think that's probably
that's correct. Fair to say.
And so would it also be rational to say that their disapproval at this point in time is based on the disapproval that they would have had before?
Yes.
Okay, so, and what we are getting here is, in your judgment, a higher level of design than the compromise position.
Correct.
So, so we could end up better off even if we go with this, but the design review board.
It was not comfortable because it still didn't go as far as they thought it should go with the overall original intent for the center and what their conditions were before.
And what was the vote?
It was 5-1. And I'll note also that when I provided Carla with this information, I made a mistake on who wasn't there. It was actually Delight Clark who wasn't there instead of Mr. Bottomley. So.
Okay. And you'll get us a full report so we can read all the comments that were made by the design review board?
Yes, it's in the back.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions on this one? To you, Mayor.
Okay. That, any other items for September 17th meeting? All right, let's go back then to our study session agenda. Item number two is hear a presentation and discuss expenditure limitation alternatives.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. There is a packet in front of you that coincides with the PowerPoint that I'll be doing this morning for you. Our intention this morning is just to introduce the subject matter on expenditure limitation alternatives and then have further discussion on it next week. So we wanted to go through and do this presentation on background and history and what our requirements are and then entertain further discussion and questions that we can do some further research on for you. Most of the expenditure, well, all the expenditure limitation issues are tied up in the Constitution and then case law, refining it thereafter. The Constitution requires us to adopt a balanced budget, and what that means to the city is we have to budget within our estimated revenues and resources. Expenditures cannot exceed that. Constitution imposes an expenditure limitations on all cities and towns. It's based on your 1979-80 expenditures, and then it's got an adjustment factor each year for growth and inflation. And the Department of Economic Security does those estimations of inflation or growth for us and does the economic deflator that you use for that. But the Constitution does allow a local government to approve an expenditure limitation alternative. And there's really three types that would apply to us in this situation. First of all, we currently have a home rule issue, and I'll go into the history a little bit later. But home rule allows the city to determine its own expenditure limitation, period. Whatever budget you adopt within your resources is your budget. The permanent base adjustment is you go in and make a one-time adjustment to raise the limit to an to what you don't think you will have to come back any near term and adjust it again. It's a larger dollar amount. Then you have one-time override alternatives, and there are other issues in the Constitution that does allow overrides, but this is the ones on operational which is affecting us. So you could do a one-time, but it's for 1 year only for a specific set of expenditures. Now, the issue that currently is going on in the state is that all the major municipalities have an approved alternative expenditure of one form or another. There's only 13 towns and cities in all the state that don't have a currently approved limitation alternative. Kind of go into what the requirements are for each of those three types that we just talked about, home rule, permanent base adjustment, and the one time. For a home rule expenditure limitation, it must be referred to the voters by a two-third vote of the city council. It's required to be presented at a regularly scheduled election for the nomination or election of city council members. And what that means, it can be done at the primary or the general election of the council. If approved, it will apply for four succeeding fiscal years immediately following the election. The permanent base adjustment also requires the two-thirds vote and is required to also be presented at a council election. The one-time override has a few more restrictions. Also requires the two-thirds vote. It has a specific amount of the override, and it must state how the additional funds would be used, such as for police, fire, streets, and it must be budgeted separately. The issue with it applies for one fiscal year and doesn't affect any subsequent fiscal years. So it does not give you any more permanent capacity in any way, shape, or form. So you would, in essence, in the following year, have to reduce your budget back to the imposed limitation. There are sanctions for exceeding the expenditure limitation. The Auditor General is the one that reviews all submitted expenditure limitation reports, and there's three levels of penalties. If you exceeded the expenditure limitation by less than 5%, your penalty is matching whatever that over expenditure was. If it's between 5 and 10%, you're going to go three times the excess. And then if you have greater than 10%, it'll be five times the excess or one-third of the state income tax allocation, whichever is less. So it gets fairly severe on your penalty escalation. Let's go into the history of Mesa's home rule. There was a home rule expenditure limitation approved in Mesa in the early 1980s. It was not referred to voters for renewal when it expired, so the limitation was sufficient to cover. It wasn't deemed necessary to ask for an alternative expenditure limitation. Now, another home rule alternative was approved in March of 2000. It was renewed in March of 2004, and this is the one that's set to expire in June of 2008. And everybody will remember our conversations with the changing the elections, and I'll go through some of those complications here in a little bit. So that will expire unless it's again approved by the voters. Now we'll go into the effect that election cycle had on us. In 2005, the state legislature required all cities with a population greater than 175,000 to have their council elections, primary elections in September, and general elections in November. With the timing of that, our home rule would have expired before our voters would have had to have changed or had a chance to vote on extension of the home rule prior to another election being held, a general election or a primary election, which would have qualified under the state constitution. So to prevent that expiration, the legislature granted a one-time exemption in this last past legislative session to change that cycle. So with that, we're going to have our 2008 elections in March, so that if we so choose to refer an exemption, alternative exemption, that can be voted on prior to the June 30th expiration. Now, what has driven Mesa's growth and expenditures in excess of what the growth factor is and the inflation factor? And that's primarily due to the locally approved voter initiatives. You've got the quality of life approval, you've got the local street sales tax, you've got the regional Prop 400 transportation improvements. All of those expenditure factors, even though the monies are raised locally, would not fit in the normal growth pattern that is allowed under your imposed expenditure limitation. So that is what's causing the upward pressure. If we don't come forward with an alternative for the March election, in 08-09, we're estimating, based on latest available information, we'd be approximately $100 million over that imposed limitation. So that means either cutting $100 million out of next year's budget, or going forth exceeding that limitation, and we would be subject to what we're estimating about a $22.2 million penalty in 9-10 on our state shared revenues. So here's the calendars of our consideration. If we went with a home rule alternative, on the September 20th, if you wanted to continue the discussions subject to a home rule option, we would be publishing notices in the paper on the 29th of September, October 6th, and then holding two public hearings, the first one on October 15th and the second one on November 5th. And then in a special meeting, then you would call for the resolution for the election in March. If we were going to consider the permanent base adjustment and you wanted to continue those discussions beyond, well, you could just do this without, because there is no public hearing requirement. So on the 20th, you decide you want to continue those discussions, all we have to do is call the question on November 5th. Now, there are some further complications due to the change, slide 15. Currently in yellow, as you see in the bar up there, that represents what would, if we had a successful home rule option approved, it would be in effect until June 30th, 2012. The problem is we wouldn't have an election cycle because of that fall requirement again. We would be required in September 2010 council election to call another home rule option if we continued with the home rule options. That is a council election only, so we would have to incur some expenditures to make it a citywide election. So I just put in for a third option the item in green. If you wanted to get it back on the same cycle with citywide, so we're not incurring special election cost or citywide cost, you would have to call another election September 2012 to get us back in sync with that cycle. I've included on the next two slides the Phoenix September 11th home rule ballot language. They just called for a home rule election. As you've known for the last 2 years, our budget's been a little bit inflated as we viewed it, because we've had to include trust funds and internal service expenditures, which are really not expenditures, they're double counts. It's the accounting issue. So they included, and I've highlighted it in red here on the screen, established exclusions will continue to apply. So I've been in contact with the Auditor General to get the language we would need to insert back into our ballot language to ensure that we would not have to inflate our budget by those items again. Now, they had a successful passage of their home rule by 73% to 27%. And that was a quick presentation, but if you have any questions, we'd like to do the research to follow up on any of the items that you're curious about, and then come back next week.
Mayor. Mayor, I appreciate Chuck's presentation, a very fairly complicated issue. yet it also comes to be something fairly simple. What the citizens of Mesa, I think, have done the home rule exemption three times previously. So we're come back on that cycle for the a four-year request. What this Constitution does is it puts a restriction on cities, essentially to live by a formula that at this point is nearly reaching 30 years old. So it's getting to be a fairly archaic way of looking at municipal budgeting. It really would put significant restrictions on the city if we didn't proceed. You can see that the city of Phoenix, I think this is their sixth consecutive time that they've approved the override on the home rule. And when you look at the list of the cities that haven't done this alternative limitation, they're very small cities that probably haven't experienced a tremendous amount of growth in the last several years. What we are suggesting today is to be here to answer questions as best we can regarding the two options that are before us, home rule and permanent. We would then propose to come back to the council on the 20th get further direction before we would have to begin calling for establishing the notices and establishing the public hearing. So we're not necessarily seeking the specific direction today. We've already anticipated another study session next Thursday morning to have that discussion. But we wanted to give council at least two opportunities to talk about this before we made any final decisions to go forward. Thank you.
Okay. Let me start out on this one if I could. I've studied this a lot over the years and have always liked the idea of the population and inflation being a limiting to government expenditures. When you get into transportation, sometimes you have to index it because construction materials for highways and bridges and steel and concrete might go up more than your some of your other materials, especially if you've got construction in China or something in the world market that really changes it. So I've not been totally comfortable knowing that population and inflation match up well with municipal service delivery. I think it does because so much of it is labor costs, but there may be some aspects of the delivery because we do construction projects. I'm not quite sure I know the magnitude of the construction projects and whether that would be a higher level then. And then if you lock in on population and inflation, some years it doesn't work.
Right.
The other aspect of it that I've always been troubled with is you can bond yourself into a problem later. So you can go ahead and do a bunch of bonding. Doesn't count against it. And then you pass it on to some other council in 20 years where they have to service that debt load. So that never made a lot of sense to me on how to get around the expenditure limitation. That being said, I do like the idea of a one-time expenditure adjustment so that you move your base to something else that's more realistic. But it would have to be moved with the caveat that if a voter-approved election took place, that also changes that base because it was approved by the voters. And that's not possible to do under this scenario.
No, it's not.
So if you wanted to go from a half cent to three quarters of a cent or 1.5 to 1.75 like we did, we wouldn't be able to expend the money that was approved. And I'm concerned about a statewide transportation election that may be placed on the ballot here in the upcoming years to do something statewide with the interstates and connectivity from county to county. And if we were a participant and had projects in that and it passed, my understanding is we couldn't spend the money if we were locked in at a lower rate, similar to the Prop 400.
The only alternative you would have, Mayor, was the point that you brought up. You're forced to borrow and bond everything that you spend for capital because debt service is excluded under the expenditure limitation. And I'm not quite sure that the inflation factor, given a growing city, is ever going to be sufficient because of the pressures. I'm not sure it matches up well on the inflator with the population number. There's just too many pressures there when you have to add such as a large utilities facility. You've got spikes in given years that you're taking on new layers of operating costs that just aren't reflected in an inflator. So I think there's some pressures there. And then it does force you, as you say, to plan your financing around borrowing everything that's capital.
Yeah. Well, that being said, how do you get there? I mean, we have a financial model that we've created for the city that goes out 20 years, and that gives us a, and I think this council's done a lot of work on that. I hate to turn it over to somebody else that says, I can run through my four-year term of office and build all these things, and somebody else can figure out how to pay them. So I have a concern on kind of the legacy of turning this over in good financial condition, and it stays in good financial condition. And that's why I kind of like the population inflation, which does hold it in check. And if we do a whole home rule exemption, give some other, I mean, obviously you still have to have a balanced budget, but.
Well, I think maybe one of the subject matters that's going to be on the Audit and Finance Committee meeting today is financial policies. I mean, if you, I think that may be the best approach that you can, is some reasonable policies that you plan your financial future by, and then you use your financial forecast to meet those goals.
Yeah, but how do you do that? This is a constitutional one. This really locks the elected officials in.
Well,
the other one is kind of a policy that the council has, but can go to the...
Yeah, and Mayor, I don't know if there's any way any current or future council can bind future councils. I mean, yeah, at the same time, I think we put in place, you know, solid financial planning that hopefully on its own establishes those merits. I think the difficulty with this process, these limitations, is it takes away that local decision-making process. It essentially binds you against something that you have no local control. If this community decides it wants to pass a sales tax for police and fire, more police and firemen, it wouldn't be able to do that, or it would be restricted to do that under the, you know, restrictions here. And so I think what we're suggesting is, I mean, somewhere along here we have to make a decision one way or another to move forward, or we go back to, I guess the question is, I certainly don't think we're looking at trying to go back to the formula that living into, you know, 1979, 1980. The question is going forward, who's in the best position to make the decision about what it is that, you know, was reasonable between the burden of taxes and the level of services that need to be rendered in this community?
Couldn't you do a hybrid, though, in which if you were to have a statewide election, let's use a City of Mesa sales tax election, we're going to go from 1.5 to 1.75, put it on the ballot, at the same time you put in a base adjustment for home rule to allow that money that's going to be collected to be increased. Because you can do base adjustments multiple times, right? So you could just work at the base adjustment idea and just ratchet it up in conjunction with the election.
You're talking the permanent base adjustment, Mayor?
Yes.
Yes, you could. Yeah, but the problem is, I think you could use your forecast to set your permanent base adjustment and then come back and give those considerations. You wouldn't necessarily have to tie an election to that specific. I can see the purpose that you're driving toward. But if you use maybe your forecast to set that permanent base adjustment out there into that 2025 period, at least you're going to have to come back and revisit it at that point in time.
But then, Chuck, that number
is
that's the thing, Mary, is that it's that sticker shock of that number into talking about a number today that far out to the future, you know, could be fairly significant. It would be a tremendous number that you would be asking. You'd have to state for the voters to approve versus each year adopting the budget.
I thought the number changed. I thought the number was the 1980 number, and it ratchets up by population inflation. The number doesn't ratchet up?
No. The number stays. When you do a permanent base adjustment, you're giving yourself a number into the future to grow to.
So you have to project out whatever that number would be in the future.
So we say we'd like a permanent adjustment to $2.5 billion, and everybody goes...
That's
but Mayor, if I might add, what the permanent base adjustment does is it raises the 1979 dollar that the state starts with, and it establishes a new number. Going forward, that number would increase based on the state's equation on inflation and population.
Yes. That's what I was saying.
You have to get that large number up there above where you want to be.
You just adjust it to your existing expenditure level. So you go from 30 million to 300 million, right? And then
yes, and then from this point forward, if it was passed in 2008, for next fiscal year, the state would tell us, based on this new number that's been adjusted, the new base, plus population and inflation.
Right.
Here is your new number. I think, however, what Chuck and Chris are saying is that in the future, if additional taxes are approved by the voters, that would not have been considered in this number.
Right.
So you may need an additional permanent base adjustment.
Or you throw it on the same ballot.
Or you throw it on the same ballot.
So there is a way to do it. Okay, let's have some more discussion. Tom?
I'm not sure I understand what you just said, Chuck. If I wanted to do a permanent base adjustment, couldn't I make the permanent base adjustment what I believe the 08-09 fiscal year budget is going to be, and then let the budget grow by growth and inflation after that?
If you so chose.
I don't have to go out and pick what it's going to be in 2025 and come up with a sticker shock.
No, but my view is, from a prudent standpoint, we've proven through the forecast we're growing faster. I think the inflators, once you reach your maturity and your build-out situation, some of those pressures are off. But I would contend that those ratios of the inflators and population growth have proven not to keep up.
What we're saying is the adjustments in the state constitution don't work for us. If council wants to set a number and say this is the number and then we'll use those population inflation, that's fine. Our experience is we'll only get further behind.
But I'm being told here that the reason that we're exceeding the 79-80 limits is because of these local and regional revenue sources that have been passed.
Those are the primary drivers.
Right. Are there others? Have we exceeded?
Yes. I would contend, like in the last 4 or 5 years, one of the things that's been driving us real strongly is personnel costs. We've been going up 4 to 5% alone on personnel costs because of retirement and health insurance issues. Those are drivers we have no control over as a local government, but they do cause us to inflate our prices. And with our current formula, where we've got a limitation on the current level of staffing or services, it will not give you any relief at all. You'll just continue to ratchet down your services is what will happen.
What do they mean by inflation here? What is it? Is it a general CPI? Is it industry? Can we mix and match, as the mayor was saying? Are we able to take into account the construction?
Yeah.
No, it's a deflator that the Department of Economic Security provides you the factor.
Okay. Once you do a permanent base adjustment, is your only option after that to do continuing permanent base adjustments if you have an increase in local revenue, or can you also do a home rule?
You can go back to a home rule if you so chose.
Okay.
It says it's permanent, but you can have another election after 2 years?
Correct, after 2 years. So if you adopt a permanent base adjustment and in 2 years the council wants to put a home rule initiative on the ballot, you can do that.
So basically, by taking a permanent base adjustment, we're basically saying we're going to take everything that's happened between 1979 and 80 and 2007, 2008, and we're going to include all that in our expenditure base, including the Prop 400, quality of life, increase in the sales tax, everything that's happened. Now we're starting over again, essentially. And we're limited to growth plus inflation from that point forward unless we have another home rule election or unless we have a permanent base adjustment that might coincide with an increase in local revenue that are approved or even a base adjustment that's because of a statewide election.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'd have to, before I could make a decision as to which way to go, I'd like to see a breakdown as to how much of the $100 million that were projected to exceed the base or the 07, the 79-80 base, the $100 million that's projected on page 12, how much of that is attributable to the increase in the revenue sources and how much of it is attributable to factors other than that, whether it's employee cost, personnel cost, whether it's whatever. I'd like to know how we got $100 million over the 79-80 number. And then I can decide whether or not it's, as you the word primarily was actually, I marked that on here because that tells me it probably means more than 50%, but doesn't mean it's 97%. So I'd like to see that before I can make a decision. But I do think it's important to recognize that a permanent base adjustment doesn't lock us into that forever, because we still have the home rule options and we still have the adjustment, another adjustment of the permanent base adjustment.
Sure.
So, okay, thank you.
And Mayor, the other concern I think too is
That's one way to go. The other option, obviously, is that the home rule option then gives a council the opportunity to make those decisions each year. And I guess some of the concern is, as you think about some of the things we've talked about going forward and our concerns about public safety, concerns about not just the capital side of public safety and to be able to build new fire stations, but how we're going to staff those new fire stations, how we're going to address a lot of public safety issues in police and fire. And that, mm-hmm. I think that's a concern, is if you set a number, then how does that affect ultimately, you know, stayed at this current level of service, is that's going to be adequate for the city? Are we looking forward to doing something different in the future? And so those are concerns that we have to, I think, thinking out. We have to think not only 2 years, 4 years, but we have to think beyond that and what impact any decisions made here on adjusting the budget with any anticipated plans to deal with some of our public safety concerns.
Right, but with your scenario, you could time the election and do those every 2 years when you know what money you need for public safety and the rest. You could also include on that ballot, because it would be a general election, to adjust the base again or to go to home rule. So I think you can get around
that. Well, to permanent every 2 years, is what you're saying?
It's a 2-year cycle on those issues.
You could.
Have to match them on the election. If you vote for this, also need this in order for it to be expended. So if you want the fire and police, you also have to adjust the base so we can spend the money that we collect. So, all right, Vice Mayor.
Okay, I have a couple of questions that will help me clarify whether I want to say what I was going to say. Is the permanent base adjustment number determined by some formula of law, or can we look at those projections and say, we know that we're going to build those fire stations, this is what we project it's going to cost us to staff those fire stations? Yes?
Yes, you can.
So we can look at that. When we're looking at the number for the permanent base adjustment, does it include our current debt service?
Well, debt service is excluded from the expenditure limitation, so it's not a factor that we have
to consider. So when we're looking at it, are we generally speaking, at our general fund budget?
No, you're looking at all expenditures of the city.
All expenditures. So our purchases of water, electricity,
gas.
Okay, that's where I see that we have a potential problem, because if the costs of those go up, I think that that's a real problem for us that we can't control. I'd say that's the bigger factor, because what I'm looking at is, for me, it makes some sense to go with a hybrid model here, which is you do a permanent base adjustment and you target that you're going to go for home rule again when you get back in the cycle. Because I think we've got a cycle issue here as a result of the legislature changing our election dates. And so to me, it makes some real sense to do a permanent base adjustment and target 2012 for a home rule election, so you aren't doing election. But the concern I have is how you make that number so that you don't have that sticker shock that Chris was talking about, because I thought that's what's going to happen. People are going to look at this and say, what do you mean the city of Mesa wants a $2 billion budget? But if you build in cushion for commodity cost increases that, you know, we provide to people, water, electric, gas, if those have to be included, I think we've got a problem. And I'm not sure quite how we overcome that problem with the base adjustment formula.
Mike?
On page 16, you've got Phoenix's home rule language. They approved a 0.4 public safety tax with the same home rule election. Did their home rule exclusion then take into consideration the passage of that 0.4?
They don't have to, under that scenario, they don't even have to worry about it.
Because they did home rule, they don't have to worry about it.
They did home rule, but set the limit. Would that include that?
No, they didn't set a limit. Set the limit is set by the council each budget period.
So that would enable us, I mean, I don't think we can afford to wait until 2012 for additional public safety dollars. So if we do the permanent, then we're stuck until 2012 unless we come back in 2010. Am I figuring this wrong?
Yeah.
Why is that?
May I respond? Because what you do is you include in your permanent base adjustment what you will need for that. You adjust for the amount of money you will need for those police and fire personnel. you include that in your base adjustment. And what I'm saying is you put in a base adjustment that's high enough to get you past 2012. So you include those costs.
And yet you could go with a special sales tax election in 2010 or 2012 or whenever.
You include that in there in your formula.
All right. But you would not have to do that with home rule. You could just set your annual budget.
It's your annual budget.
As long as it's balanced, you're fine. Tom?
Yeah, I think the point that Claudia made is a good one, but that's why I want the details as to why we're exceeding. If we're exceeding 1% because of those issues over the last 3 or 4 years, then that doesn't give me as much grief as if those commodities are driving 25% of our overage. And so that's why I want the data so that I can make an evaluation. But your point's well taken.
Kyle?
Well, I do know that some of our utility contracts are expiring in the next couple of years, and we are having uncertainty as to what those commodities will be. Are the contracts we have for gas and electricity. So we don't know what that number is going to be, and it may be considerably different from what it is today. And until we negotiate those contracts, we don't know what it's going to be. So that uncertainty is very concerning if you lock yourself into something.
Right. Is the internal service accounting still part of home rule as far as the number?
It is currently. If I would propose, if we do refer home rule, that we put in the exclusionary language so that we can pull those back out of our appropriation.
So do we go back to 1978 and see how much of it would have been had we double accounted for it back then?
I'm not sure I even have data that far back. But
because it would have been interesting to see how it had inflated. If we had to change it today, you should have changed it in the original base.
Well, even just to know, Mayor, what difference that would make in your adopted budget number.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, that's the best we, right now, we could tell you that, because today you have to adopt a budget.
$20 million for that factor.
That includes that number. And so this would exclude that in the future, so you're not doing that double counting.
Okay, that'll make Tom's calculation even more complicated.
It would drop your budget by about $75 million, not having the trust funds, which are quasi-governmental, and the internal service funds. In our current budget.
Okay, but in fairness, it really should have been adjusted in 78-80 and then move forward if it was changed the philosophy of accounting.
It was an interpretation of in the law that the Auditor General was applying from the first home rule election we had to the second home rule.
Yeah.
That's how we got it.
Okay, Rex.
Sort of a series of questions, but Scottsdale's budget is about equal to ours for with half the number of residents. How do they handle it?
I believe they're a permanent base adjustment city. In the council report that I gave you, attachment number 2, Scottsdale is permanent base adjustment approved in 06-07.
Okay. About a third of our budget is utilities, a third is the general fund. We actually run the city out of it, and about a third is construction bonds, reserves. Now, the bonds and reserves are not considered in this budget.
The debt service on the bonds.
Just the debt service.
Right, is excluded.
But the utilities, is 300 and some million, is included in this. So every time we get more residents, they buy more water, they flush their toilets or whatever it is, we get penalized. The more people move in, then the formula shifts.
Well, the pressures that causes on that formula are making sure that that formula actually recognizes the full cost of a growth factor, which could be questionable. But then the ratio of the expenditures, you made some very good points. We're heavy in construction. Does that inflator allow for your construction factors? The personnel costs. I don't think it's been very good at matching up what the drivers have been on our personnel costs. So that's where our growth and inflation factors, where we get our pressures from. So it's automatically assuming this growth ratio that's imposed on us is accurate. I would contend it's not. It's not sufficient in a growth factor city. If we were at build out and you're at a static level of service, you're not having as many pressures related to that.
Is there any movement for legislators to redo and update the formula for the 1979 legislation? For them to fix this statewide rather than each city trying to hodgepodge this thing together? I see a smiling face coming forward.
My favorite subject. Mayor, Councilmember Griswold, no, I wouldn't say that there's any belief of the legislature right now that needs to be revisited.
Okay, thank you.
The Scottsdale permanent base adjustment and how they set that and some of the reasons for doing that. Could we make an inquiry as part of the background information to see how they've handled it in that city? Okay. All right.
Tucson is huge from 89.
Sounds like there's two or three of them that have permanent base adjustments. Why don't we study the logic and reason behind those cities doing that and how they handled it?
And excuse me, I heard Scottsdale, Peoria, Tucson. Anybody else?
Yeah, I think you've...
Yeah, Tucson, Tucson is, you know, they've had the same in place since 88, 89. I wonder how large of a budget expenditure they went at that time.
Well, I just got an inquiry from Tucson. They are considering the home rule option in this upcoming election for them.
Because they were limited growth for a long period of time.
Okay. Rex.
The reason I picked Scottsdale is they have double per resident taxation than the Mesa residents get. They pay more than twice. And how do they get there and why do they justify it? So, thank you.
Yeah. This, the more you get into this, the more complicated it begins. If we get, we were talking about utilities. Well, if we start conserving water more, our budget actually goes down, depending on the cost of our water supplies, obviously. But
right. Yeah. It's gas and electric that drive us on the commodity side.
All right. Other questions, comments, Tom?
I just want to list another couple of cities to look at that are, seem to have had a lot of growth. Fountain Hills is permanent base adjustment, and Goodyear is permanent base adjustment, and both of those are growing real fast, too. So,
all right. Scott?
I think if you look at Fountain Hills, however, their budget right now survives largely off of their growth. They're receiving a lot of money from developers and fees and incurring a lot of debt. And as soon as that ends in about 5 years, they're going to be in big trouble from talking to some of their folks over there. I have major concerns about, I think if we were at build out, I'd be a little bit more comfortable, but we have major growth coming at GM Proving Grounds. And how is that going to fund? That's going to be a major economic hub. We're talking about second urban core. And if we aren't absolutely on a sound financial footing here, that is really going to affect that. I'm also concerned about what will happen in the future with voter-approved regional transportation sales tax dollars. If another Prop 400 comes forward, we're going to have to put in another, if I got this right, we'll basically also have to put on the bond aid another permanent base adjustment in order to use that money or leverage that money?
If you went the permanent base adjustment and you set the limit where we had to ratchet it each time.
Where we'd have to ratchet it up in years. So every 2 years we're coming up with a permanent base adjustment, another permanent solution to something that isn't permanent. So it's a temporary base adjustment until we have to figure out another time that we're going to have to ratchet it up in order to utilize the money that otherwise we can't utilize those revenues. And Mesa, for on the Prop 400, may not be able to spend that money on our own transportation projects. Every 2 years or so with, unless you set that pretty high, we're going to be coming back every 2 years and confusing the heck out of people on a permanent base adjustment. Wait a minute, didn't I just do this like 2 years ago? That's not very permanent. I'm a little, boy, we're walking on some uneven ground. All right.
Mike?
The schools have the override elections. That deals with their capital increases. Is that correct?
That deals with their primary property tax for overriding on their operating budgets. And they're
similar to a home rule, but dealing with...
It's a specific election allowing the override.
They don't have a permanent base adjustment option. They just have the override.
The override.
One thing about home rule that makes it more attractive to the voters as they're used to voting for it. When you say the word permanent, you tend to bring those out who are concerned about where we're going. I guess that would be my only concern.
Deb?
Mayor, I just want to make sure the council understood what you're going to be asked next week and what are the time frames. Under the Constitution and the state statutes, to place a home rule question on the ballot, we have to provide specifics with regard to notifications in the newspaper, and we have to hold two public meetings before council can call the election. For the permanent base adjustment, we are not required by state statute to hold those same public hearings. But that doesn't mean, so next week you're going to be asked to give direction. Do you want us to start the process so that council can consider the home rule measure if it so chooses? Your final decision won't be until November. That doesn't mean next week you have to say we're taking home rule over permanent base adjustment. It's just putting in place to give council the option to go forward with home rule or permanent base in November. And in fact, the Constitution even allows you to place both questions on the ballot if the council chose. But I just didn't want you to think that you were choosing one or the other next time.
And Mayor, let me just say this, though. If we were to go with permanent, which is certainly an option, what if kind of questions have to be answered, and being able to set a number out there. And, you know, we deal with the budget around this table quite often. So when we hear numbers like 300 million or, you know, a billion, we can break that down and understand that. I think the scariest thing for us is how do you go out into the public? And certainly, we've been trying to do a much better job of explaining that publicly. But I can tell you it's still very difficult to understand how, you know, cities, for some people, can understand a $1 billion budget. Now, we're glad to sit down and try. We need to do a better job. We've tried to go out and explain it to everybody, and we appreciate, you know, the media trying to help us. But it gets a little concerning to try to explain, here's $1 billion today, but we need, what do we need in the future based on what scenarios? And my only concern is if we do go to permanent, which is certainly the prerogative of the council, is we need to make that decision fairly soon in the process, only because it will take a significant amount, I think, of education about what that number, how that number breaks down, what does it mean. So that's just something to consider.
Okay. Scott and Kyle?
I don't know that we'll have all the answers to those questions, but at least we have to try to understand what some of the consequences of these actions are going to be, and potentially what some of the unintended consequences are going to be, however remote they may end up turning out to be. Because they're, unlike Scottsdale, we do not have a lot of slack in this budget. Mesa runs a pretty darn thin budget, as it is. We might disagree on how we spend it in certain areas, but it's pretty trim compared to others. So we need to understand that if down the road, if it isn't approved, we may end up having problems that will end up with fewer fire stations, fewer police officers, or we're not able to spend the money from that we would be able to get from the region, from the state on transportation issues. We have to understand that's a possibility.
Okay, Kyle?
I think it's important to still emphasize again, having the comparison with other cities that have done the base adjustment, mm-hmm. You need to make sure you do apples with apples, because again, they don't have the electric, they don't have the gas like we do, and that has to be included. And the uncertainty of the future contracts of what those commodities will cost us is a complete unknown. But by the same token, we went through the lean years where we did not have revenue, that we put off a lot of things that we are now trying to play catch up on. I mean, like when we replaced a 30-year-old utility truck, those are expenditures that we're having to look forward to, that makes the budget look different than it might have been had we been able to keep up on certain things. So the comparison, however important it is, and I think we need to look at the comparison, but make sure when we compare, we're comparing apples with apples and oranges with oranges, so we know exactly where we stand on how they did those things. That's why the home rule, where it just says we go to whatever our approved budget is a safer bet, understanding that we're going to have the scrutiny when we have those budget deals. But the permanent adjustment with so many variables is a scary thought to me.
Okay, Rex?
So, do you have any information? About 3 years ago, the book came out, Financing Government, and had the study of economic and the least expensive cities in the United States, and we were third rated, you know, right behind Las Vegas and Arlington. The voters passed a transportation tax to fix our roads, et cetera. Has there any new studies come out where we rate in the top 50 cities in the United States?
The authors of The Price of Government, I haven't seen a new study. We can investigate that, but I have not seen
a new
study.
I'd like to see where we do. I know it's hard for people to believe we're the third least expensive in the entire United States, but it's also hard to believe we're only 39,000 people behind Atlanta in population. So we're no longer a small city. It's a major city in the United States. I think we're the 38th largest city in the United States now. So those figures would help me to compare where we are and how we're doing. So thank you.
Okay. Vice Mayor.
I'm assuming that next week when you come back, we're going to have some preliminary numbers of what that permanent base adjustment might need to look like. I mean, without that, I don't have a good sense. And also, some preliminary looks at energy contracts, how long those contracts would last for, what they would look like, because without that...
I don't think we've even done the RFP yet for the electric, so that's still sitting out there. We can give maybe what the market is today. But
okay,
that's
maybe
be,
some market looks at it. I go back to the comments that Councilmember Whalen made, and I think it's true. I think people see, you know, it on the ballot over and over. It's a concern. The thing is that they're going to see it something on the ballot over and over again as a result of the legislature changing our election. And I remember the first time I saw the term home rule, I liked that term. I liked it. And I thought, yeah, I'm in favor of home rule. And I thought I was giving approval, you know, many, many, many years ago, I thought I was giving approval for this to happen, and then it was done. I had already given approval. And so to discover that you have to keep on giving approval is also confusing to people. Kino, I think all of us here are sensitive to the fact that we've taken the slings and arrows. We've been through the tough stuff, and it is hard to think about turning that over to somebody who doesn't appreciate just how difficult that was and the fact that we could have ignored all of this. I remember that conversation we had, you know. We could have ignored it. We could have... There were ways of getting through this period of time and passing it on to somebody else in 2008 and letting them open the box and say surprise. And we didn't choose to do that. We chose to make the tough decisions. And as a result, it's hard to think about handing that on and thinking that somebody isn't going to be as attentive to it as we have been. So I appreciate what you're trying to do.
All right, it takes two-thirds vote, which is 5 for either one. Okay. Tom?
If I can piggyback on what the Vice Mayor said, that's my driving concern here is that this council is going to change, whether there's 5 different or 4 different, or we only know for sure that there's going to be 2 people on the next council that are from this council. And this council has worked very hard, I think, to regain some credibility in the community with our budgeting practices and our financial decisions and our forecasting, and you know, led by the mayor, and I'm uncomfortable leaving and turning over a blank check for 4 years to the next council. Now that's what they're elected to do and stuff, but the idea of some kind of fiscal stability and legacy is driving my desire to explore the permanent base adjustment alternative. I don't know where I'm going to come down, but that's really the motivating factor. I don't want to lose that credibility by being perceived as giving the next council a carte blanche for 4 years.
Okay, we'll see this one back. Appreciate the presentation and give us a heads up on the discussion for later. Item number 3 is hear a presentation and discuss potential capital bond projects for police and fire.
Mayor and Council, as our group's getting together front, let me just kind of introduce us a little bit. What we are presenting to you today is just focusing on the capital needs of both just the police and fire departments. We've sat down since we last met with Council and reviewed some of these projects. Most of these projects will not be new to the Council. What we've done, though, is try to really scrub down the priorities and prioritize them. So Council asked to do is come back with a prioritization list, which we didn't identify before, trying to work on the cost, looking out into the future. We're not prepared today to really get into how these would be paid for and what the tax impact might be, if any, going forward. What we're really here to do is focus on presenting to the Council a comprehensive list of the capital needs and the O&M impact of those capital needs to the city, looking out into the future. We will make that presentation here today. Certainly, we anticipate a tremendous amount of follow-up and questions either today or in the future, and certainly look forward to working and communicating this to the community also. Following this presentation this month, we will also be bringing back to you the transportation CIP for the next 5 years that would fit in the same time period. So the purpose really is just to review projects. We're not getting in necessarily on the how they would be paid for, but really the nature, the scope of the projects, and the anticipated capital cost and O&M cost. So with that, Chuck, you're going to start it off.
Right. Just to tag on to a few of the questions or the comments that Chris brought up. What we've attempted to do is scrub these projects for the period of 08-09 through 12-13, which would be components that we're identifying today that are not currently in our CIP plan. So these are not currently funded. There are components of these programs that might include design that are in our current CIP plan, but no plans for execution of construction and going forward. We presented these to you in preliminary form in May when we were discussing these, so they should be familiar. What we have done today was we've broken these down into three groupings for presentation. There are four projects that we've got on here in priority order that are joint public safety projects. They have citywide public safety implications. Then we've got five projects that are police and seven projects that are for fire. And the presentation package are listed as 1 through 16. That is just for reference purposes for you. So the priority, they're broken down within their groupings of what the priority is by each of the specific groups. We've also included a second package to the PowerPoint that gives you a complete listing of the project's total cost. And the cost is the base year cost, as we've got it in the CIP, forecasted out into the future where that project would start. So that's what that's representing, what we're planning for it to cost into the future. We've also included in that listing the first full year of O&M. So we didn't always take the first year because that's not a true representation of what the ongoing cost of that projects are. So there may be some one-time costs that would come in on specific projects that would cause the first year to spike. But if this is first full year of operations, that's also been put through the forecast to inflate out into the future periods based on whatever components it's got in its cost listing. We've had all these projects reviewed and scoped for all the components through engineering. They've provided all the base cost. We've attempted to present this in the most common sense approach that we can today. First slide. We have city demographics of approximately 460,000, 132 square miles, and we've projected those public safety needs to meet the next 5 years' needs. And I've already introduced, really, the three groupings, and I'm going to turn this over, and I believe it's Cheryl that was going to present on projects, the joint projects, public safety.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. I'm Cheryl Butler, Police Technical Services Manager. And I guess I drew the lucky card because of the dollar signs with this. That first slide is the emergency radio communication system upgrades. That involves a fairly substantial item as you look at the particular bullet points. We're addressing interoperability and regional concerns with the wireless system. There are some significant changes with respect to the technology and FCC compliance of regulations that have been put into place. There are some capacity and growth concerns that we have to address. We have an aging system that definitely needs some modification to it. And we've got some particular citywide issues that deal beyond police and fire that affect some of our other city departments and partners. As you can see there, the capital cost of this is identified at this point as being $34,689,923. The first year O&M, once this is in that full year, as Mr. Odom explained, is about $330,000. You have a breakdown there of some of the particulars, or maybe not. I'm not sure that my packet matches yours.
Sure. Why don't you just explain what is what does this mean? I mean, just kind of put in some practical, everyday, out on the street, police officer, fireman, what does this mean, emergency radio communications, and why do we need to upgrade it?
Thank you, Manager, to do that. One of the items in this is $5.3 million that relate to the Topaz wireless life cycle circumstances, and that is upgrading existing equipment to keep the voice communications in place that right now is used primarily by police and fire, and to a lesser extent, in some of the other city departments. The mobile data system that is used, again, primarily by police and fire, because of some FCC banding requirements that have been mandated, will need to be replaced. That one has an interesting scenario to it. There's $2.8 million of that that will be bond capital items. We'll have another $2.5 million in the mobile equipment, which is not bondable when that change has to take place. The Topaz radio system, again, because of some of those FCC banding requirements and the upgrades to stay with our regional partners, will be an expense of about $15.9 million during this time to refresh that system and to take care of the frequency changes that have been mandated. When the system was originally designed and at its normal outgo, we're expecting reasonable building penetration when our officers are deployed into various buildings. Unfortunately, that can't address everything that's put into some of the new construction items. So we have $1.3 million in there for building treatment to make sure that our officers are as safe as they can be when they're responding inside of these buildings. We have a partnership at the present time with the Central Arizona Project to lease facilities, to rent facilities in the Thompson Peak area to handle our communications. We have a need to expand that because of coverage and the growth kind of things. So there's some money in here to expand Thompson Peak, and we're looking at a new partnership potential with the Department of Public Safety so that we're not renting equipment. We've actually become one of the landlords in that. We had included in here, I'm sorry, Vice Mayor.
Thank you. Do we have an anticipated life cycle on these things? It seems to me that we just went through doing a significant upgrade with the Motorola things in 2000, the 800 megahertz, and I think we started with that before I came on the council, so I'm guessing we started with that in the late 90s. So is this like an every 10 years we should be sort of anticipating that we're going to have a cost between $10 and $20 million to upgrade the communication systems?
Mayor, Vice Mayor, yes and no. Let me explain what I mean by that. There will be a cyclical upgrade of the equipment just because of the technology, the aging of the technology, and some of those kind of things that drive it. One of the things that is not predictable in what that influence would be is if there's FCC regulations, like the recent mandate for narrowbanding consolidation, that would cause us to have to change out equipment to meet that. We can say for certain we will go through some expenditures, perhaps not as large as this one that's looking at us right now, because we're dealing with a combination of age, mandate, and growth that all hit us at about the same time.
And Cheryl, let's just go back and break it down again, because I think it's important for the council to understand. You know, today, in today's world of emergency management, coordination, interoperability is the word. That is the Homeland Security's one of their top priorities, is having that regional interoperability. In order for us to maintain that interoperability, we have to make the investment to keep up with the region as far as where they're going to be on technology. So not only is the FCC's mandates to consolidate into these bandwidths is creating about a $2.8 million, is $3 million number, is that what you said, Cheryl?
Well, it's $2.8 million on the data side of our communication, okay, which is how we dispatch calls to police and fire units so that we make that response. The other $15.9 million is also to see that we can move from the 800 megahertz bandwidth, which okay, we presently have, to the new 700 once that narrowband consolidation is accomplished.
Okay, so all of that is important in order for us to keep up with the region and being able to engage in that interoperability.
It is,
is that fair? Okay, so this is going to happen whether we decide to do it or not. The region is moving this way. They have to, and we're already under a tremendous amount of efforts today to coordinate with Phoenix and the metropolitan areas to do that. So, okay. Anything else on this slide, I'm sure, or should we move?
Unless there are other questions by the council on this slide, we could move to the next slide. Mayor.
I was around when we went to the 800 megahertz, and it was a region-wide system. It was Phoenix, several other cities. We wanted to be part of that for the interoperability, and now we're switching to 700 megahertz. I feel like I've been had. We spent all that money. We went through the whole 800 megahertz system, and now there's a Topaz 700, and this is the one that works off from. Convinced me that this is a whole lot better system. There was a really good reason to go to 700 megahertz because we spent a fortune on that for years to get the 800 megahertz. So I hope that's not a throwaway system completely.
Mayor, Council, that is not a throwaway system completely. The towers and some of the core equipment that was put into place and recent upgrades that have been done by the city's communication department have put in some equipment that can operate both 800 and 700. The reason to move to the 700 is primarily driven by the FCC mandates. We will need to move there.
Okay, so some of the cities that didn't participate back then that now want to get into 700 are going to say, boy, we saved a lot of money by just waiting for 5 years and not going through the whole 800 system and then getting into the one that is now being used valley-wide.
Well, Mayor, that's a discussion that's going on regionally about how do you pay to be part of this process, because you have the larger cities putting in significant capital investment, and the question is, how do you share that cost throughout the region to those who would be coming in? So there is a ongoing negotiations that Gary and Cheryl and all four of these gentlemen are in right now, working with Phoenix to try to figure out how do we provide for our own, but how do we allow others to buy in or come in and be part of that system?
Yeah,
well, and share that cost.
Not inexpensively for the buy-in from the others.
I don't want an answer now, but it seems like we're going to be spending a lot of money after having already spent a lot of money because the FCC has decided to make some mandates. I just like a paper telling me why they made that change. Is 700 that much better than 800? Why do they care what wave frequency we use in our region? Again, I don't want the answers now. I don't want to hold up the meeting, but I'd like to read about why the FCC decided to make Mesa spend $18 million to comply with their mandate.
Mayor, Councilmember Ross, if I could respond very quickly to a piece of that, and then we'll come back with a detailed part of that. Radio spectrum and the frequencies cover some wide areas. What happened was that public safety frequencies that had been allocated previously and some commercial items began to overlap each other, which placed officer safety as a major issue. The FCC's solution to that was, let's put all of this together over here and let's open up a new one for public safety. I will come back with a full paper on that, but that's in a nutshell where that would be.
Vice Mayor.
And I'd like a response at some point about Homeland Security grants being used in order to offset the cost of this, because it seems to me that we're talking about Homeland Security and the federal government is mandating these changes. They ought to be anteing up on it.
Mike? I think it's important to know that had we not gone to 800 when we did, we would have had tremendous safety and efficiency problems also.
Okay.
Next slide.
We're on page 3 of 30.
The next slide has to do with another joint fire and police project, which is a public safety communications building and emergency operations center. Some of the current drivers to that is obviously we're looking at a site that was originally built back in 1988, and the slide that you see there says that it's at capacity. Actually, it's below capacity. We have some issues that we're not able to address at the present time because of that size. We do need to maintain some current standards for the ability to dispatch appropriately and to accommodate the growth that is expected in the city of Mesa. At the present time, we do not have any redundant facilities for handling our dispatching and public safety answering point communications. This would provide that redundancy. As you're probably well aware, the Emergency Operations Center that's located in the police headquarters building is undersized and not really adequate for that. So this is the opportunity to address an appropriately sized emergency communications center.
Phoenix, at least on the fire side, has the capability of some redundancy of dispatching, let's say, East Valley units. What's the limitation of that? And does the police department in Phoenix, can they also dispatch officers from Mesa PD or not at all?
Mayor, Council Member Summers, there are a couple of things that are involved in that. Phoenix Fire certainly can do some dispatching capability for Mesa units, especially if they're responding in mutual aid into some of the border cities between the two major players on that. They're at some capacity constraints as well as we are. On the Phoenix PD side, they are in a mode where Mesa would like to be in this sense. Phoenix PD has two dispatch centers. One is their primary, one is the secondary. How sensitive some of this is, that just the timing is perfect for that. 10 days ago, we had a situation that the Phoenix PD PSAP center was undergoing some programming modifications, and it took their entire system down. Mesa dispatched. Phoenix PD calls for about 45 minutes because of some of the failover to that. So we did. So there is some fail-safe redundancy in this, but not enough to provide us with the backup that we really fully need on that particular part of it.
And Cheryl, so the point is, we're outgrowing, put aside the redundancy, we're outgrowing the third floor of our building today. We're outgrowing that area. And the thought then is, if we're going to expand, instead of spending the dollars to expand in the current location, it would make more sense to go find a separate location to create a redundancy so that they wouldn't be, if one went down, you would at least have another up and going, and it would be combined with your emergency operations center at the same time. And you'd locate it so, as these guys tell me, you'd put on a separate grid and it'd be hopefully separate. So if the power went down or there was some major issue in one of the communication centers, the other would not be affected by the same incident.
Okay. Yeah, I understand the capacity issue. I think Phoenix, we're going to dispatch 300,000 calls for service this year. So.
And with that, I believe that's the two slides that I had been asked to address. Thank you.
I'm going to continue on with the joint projects for public safety. The next project is a police public safety training facility improvements. The site was established in 1986. The last classrooms were added in 1996. As we all know, both the public safety safety agencies continue to grow. And the project out there adds, let me get to my next slide here. Additional classroom space needed for special operations and simulation training, and also office space needed for police and fire training. This project at the regional public training facility is projected to cost $6.7 million, with a first-year O&M of about $230,000. Next project is the replacement of Fire Station 215 and the police station that's co-located. This facility was built in the 1950s. It was a carryover from the Williams Air Force Base to the Gateway organization. The new station that will replace Station 215 currently will be built to current fire standards and also have office space to support police operations. This station will also continue to service the growing areas of the southeast part of the city. Along with the fire station, Station 215, and the police facility, we've added an aircraft rescue firefighting truck, or ARF vehicle. The vehicle that is currently in place out at Gateway was also carried over from the military. It's a late 1970s model, which has outserved its useful life, and we need to replace that at a cost of about $1 million. Our total capital cost on the Station 215 project is $9 million, with the first year O&M of about $106,000. In summary, in the emergency in the joint public safety projects, emergency radio communication system upgrade is $34.6 million, with $329,000 in O&M. The public safety communications and emergency operations center, $27.6 million. With a first-year O&M of about $677,000. Public safety training facility improvements, $6.7 million, $230,000 in O&M. Replacement of Fire Station 215 and Police Station, $9 million and $106,000 in O&M. For a total joint capital improvement project cost of $78 million and a total first-year O&M of approximately $1.3 million.
There's a little discussion up here on the Fire Station 215, and I have a question a little bit on the location of it. Obviously, your service area, but with the future terminal be going on the east side in the master plan for the airport, have you already identified how you get across, or do you, or where's the best location for that? Has there been a locational site type of selection? Are you going to put it where the existing one is, or is there going to be searching out a new site for that?
Mayor Hawker, members of council, in the design portion of Station 215, we looked at the siding. It's originally designed right now to replace Station 15 in the current site. We have had some ongoing discussions with Gateway to move that site down towards the tower, which is about a quarter mile south. The tower location puts Station 215 midfield for ARF response onto the runway, and there will be some infrastructure improvements to be able to allow the structure vehicles and EMS vehicles to respond out of that station into the Gateway campus and the southeast community.
Okay, and what's the accounting for the usage on the airport, and the airport authority are paying, getting some type of reimbursement for that? How does that work with the city and the airport authority? Does the airport authority have to pay some of the public safety cost to secure, and I've forgotten how that works, but I know there's some.
I believe there is an accounting for a portion of the fire department services out at the airport, and I can't remember what that is, I don't remember what the number is, okay. Mayor, but there is a portion of that. And then the question becomes is also looking at it, what available dollars would be like from the FAA to help fund equipment, I think. But the improvements is something that this is unique because a lot of major airports, they have a dedicated only to be used for fire response with personnel only. And they only stay on the, they can't go anywhere else off the airport. In this case, we've set it so that it provides both on the airport service as well as, well, anything in that service area. That's a little unique. Now, as the airport grows, you know, we'll have to continue to evaluate that, because at some point, you know, I know in my past life there has been where we actually charge the full cost of personnel, equipment, to the airport. It was an airport that could pay for all those costs, and so that is something, a future to look forward to. But also, I don't want to, you know, in the question, police department is also very important. You think about all security measures and the TSA now requirements about actually having local officers on site, and so we're already starting to see, and certainly with more activity out there, that increases the demand for more police presence. So even the location today we're proposing is a joint, well, it is a joint facility today, but as we improve that to improve having public safety. But at some point, as we, like you suggested, we go to the east side, part of what we want to do is talk to, you know, well, in the planning of the new terminals, you typically embed EMS service and police, I don't know if it's a substation chief, but a police office in the terminals also. So all those things will have to be considered in the future.
All right. And the Vice Mayor and I were kind of whispering back and forth, couldn't we do this as part of that loan program? That's
our intent.
So that we can get paid back over time when the airport is profitable?
Okay. Mayor, I think that's what you and I should propose to our partners.
I concur. All right. Go ahead.
Mayor, just to briefly address the issue on the east side, I don't believe we have selected an exact location for that, but it certainly is in the plans to provide a station on the east side. And what you find in what Mr. Brady was describing is as the airport index increases based on the type of traffic going on there, at some point FAA will require a dedicated fire station that can only run on the airport. A lot of airports will supplement that station with additional stations that can run both on the airport and off the airport because of the actual operational need there. A lot of times FAA requirements don't really meet the operational need. It's just a bare minimum. So just a little more information in terms of the planning that's going on out there.
Okay. Police up next.
All right. The next item here is the replacement of the Dobson Station. The current facility there is, we have actually, we're not at capacity. We have exceeded the capacity of that location. We literally have people working out of hallways. This is an area that is continuing to grow. It's an area that also serves Riverview, and it's an area that we anticipate that probably in the next 10 years or so, we would have to have that station grow probably to somewhere around 220 personnel. So what we're proposing is to build a facility there that would take us certainly into 10 to 20 years down the road. We're looking at a facility of approximately 2,300 square feet. We have talked to the community there. Another area that we want to start developing is that we want to have full-service police stations, meaning they're not substations. They are police stations. They're open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Community members are able to come into the station at any time, complete crime reports, and seek other police services. The city is too large to have police stations that shut down at nighttime and on the weekends, and we're certainly don't believe that we're providing the best police services when it comes to that. So one of the things that we're talking about is that this will be a station that would have a full-service desk that would never close. That's more in line with the practice of major cities throughout the country. Certainly, our desire is to stay within the Dobson Ranch area, and we believe that there may be the possibility of purchasing perhaps existing retail space in that area that is not currently working very well, and building our police station there. The next item that we're looking at is the development of an arraignment center. This arraignment center would be, as it is currently planned, is looking at the current courthouse building, and that particular facility would basically be broken down into the basement floor. Would have a processing center for people that get arrested. There will also be court facilities for arraignment there. And we're looking at the Pima County model, and I'd like to have Chief Solanka give us a quick explanation of what that means.
Yes, thank you, Chief, Mayor, members of council. As you know, our current holding facility is built and been in operation since 75 and has a capacity of 27 prisoners. So what we're looking for is trying to find more efficient ways to handle processing prisoners. Last year, I believe we processed about 10,000 prisoners through our facility. And the issue here is that many more people are either arrested, cited, and released, or we file a paperwork and they're not actually brought in, booked, fingerprinted, and photographed. So what this arraignment center concept does, and Pima County seems to be one of the premier models of the country, it's kind of a one-stop shop, similar to our Center Against Family Violence, where all the services that are required during the processing, defense, court system, prosecutor, everybody is there. And instead of a traditional holding facility with bars, it's a waiting center, essentially, kind of more like a bus station than a jail. And it works very well. There's a few of them in the country. And essentially, the Pima County model is probably about as big as this room. And we are guessing that perhaps our waiting center, where prisoners, where people were waiting to get processed, probably take about half this size. In this process, there'd be like six or seven different steps. Once a person is arrested on the street, brought into the holding facility or the arraignment center, they'd be processed, asked about medical questions. We'd establish probable cause and begin the booking process. Second step would be a processing center where we'd photograph, fingerprint the people. After that process, they wait in this waiting area. There are TV screens where they will wait during the course of the day. They'll be brought sandwiches, drinks to get through it. The Pima County model has two arraignment courts a day. So theoretically, once a person is arrested on the street and brought in, the longest that they would be at that center would be 12 hours. The goal that we would have would be to have three a day, so that theoretically, once somebody's brought in from the street and brought into our processing center, they'd be held no longer than 8 hours before they go through the process and either released by the judge or held and transported to a jail. Included in this thing is all the pretrial services, social services, as I said, the prosecutor, the judge, and that's essentially the process. And I'd be open to any questions if there are any on this model.
And there are a couple of takeaways here. There will be secure holding facilities, obviously. This is kind of a self-police model, and apparently it has worked well for Pima, and we certainly like to explore it in that. The people that are being arrested basically if they start to misbehave, then they're transferring to a lockup facility. But those that do not, they're given the freedom to remain in this secure facility, but that they can move about. They can certainly have access to some entertainment, TVs, and those things to make that time go by as quickly as possible. An important point here to be made is that we're currently releasing people, we're citing people that are not being totally processed, they're not being fingerprinted, they're not putting through the process, they're not coming back, they're not showing up to court when they're supposed to, and we're spending more time and effort than trying to capture those people and bringing it back into the system. Quite frankly, some of those folks, had they been fingerprinted, we would also know that maybe we were dealing with someone else other than the person that they're saying that they are. And possibly these are people that could be wanted for more serious offenses. So we may, on the field, believe that we're dealing with someone that is a fairly minor infraction when, in fact, we have someone that is wanted for a more serious crime. This would make this process not only more efficient in terms of processing the people, but it will ensure that everybody gets the full treatment that is required. And then when it comes to transportation to the county, which is still a reality that we have to deal with, we can be more organized and we can have a bus service that does not necessarily have to be staffed by sworn officers that could several times a day make a trip to the county. So this will actually not only make us more efficient, but it will enhance our ability to provide for public safety, because we are today releasing people that we probably wouldn't if we knew who they really were, and we're spending a lot of time having to go back also and find people that are not showing up when they're supposed to be in court. So we believe that this will be probably more efficient than having a total lockup facility. But also it would give us the ability to enhance our ability to provide for public safety. It is important to note, and we'll get to this a little later, that as the city continues to grow, that we are going to still have a need to look at the east side of the city for additional processing facilities, but this will be what we believe that can work for us for the immediate future.
Tom?
I could be wrong because it happens frequently to me, but didn't the original new court building have space for in-custody arraignments?
It does. The problem that we would have, and this is an area that we have discussed with the courts, if you have the arraignment center at the new court, and we go according to the current model that we have, we're going to be expending a great deal of money transporting people from the detention facilities to the courthouse on a regular basis. We are also still going to have to address the issue of detention holding facilities, because that model will not take care of the problems that we have today. What we're trying to do is we're trying to make this operation much more efficient. Policing cost of transporting and securing prisoners going from the police facility to the court over the years to come will far exceed the expenditure that could be put at the front end by creating an arraignment center that also has the detention facility co-located. It is clearly a policy decision. Certainly, if this council decides that arraignment will be conducted at the new courthouse, that can be done. It will be a continuous cost of transportation and security that will far exceed the model where you have holding facilities and processing and arraignment facilities all in the same place.
Chief, I agree with you that it's a policy decision, and that's why I brought it up.
Right.
Because it's being presented to us today as part of a bond package, which kind of assumes the policy decision has been made.
No.
This we had a special subcommittee of this council that spent a great deal of time trying to figure out how big of a courthouse we needed, what was going to go in where, how many courtrooms we needed for arraignments. Then it came back to the full council for a detailed discussion. There was a lot of controversy. Judges weren't happy with the decisions we made. It was a compromise decision. Personally, I think what you're designing makes sense, reduces the transportation cost, reduces all these things. But we invested a whole bunch of time designing a courthouse that assumed an in-custody arraignment, and then to have a change in that decision come forward as part of a bond package, I find troubling. it should have come back to us in the context of, we're going to change the policy, and this, and then come back, and then if you approve that policy, this is how we're going to fund it. Chris, I got to tell you, I just don't like the timing of this. I don't like the way
Mayor,
it's here.
Mayor, Councilman Rawls, if you recall, the last time we brought the plans to the council, we actually said, we don't think the arraignment courts in the new court building work. We made the point that we were very concerned about the transportation costs.
Was there a decision made?
Well, there was no discussion from the council that suggested that was not the way we were going to go, and we suggested that we were going to look at, we talked about this last time, we were going to look at the old court building for an arraignment center, and we talked about the fact that what we would do then with the arraignment courts that had been previously planned is using them, flexing them out so that, again, for the new growth of other courts that we've talked about in the future, that would mitigate the need to continue to expand.
And I agree with that, and that's where I would have decided. I just don't have a recollection that this council made the decision that we're going to go this way. Maybe I'm wrong. As I said, I could be wrong.
The discussion where we made the point that we thought that was a concern that we now had about the transportation cost. Because I don't recall the council saying we will put arraignment courts in the new court building. That was something that came from the judge and presented to the council. We raised the issue about the cost of transportation. And from that discussion, we talked about then the other option would be to look at the old court building. And so that's where we come forward today.
I could be wrong, and I support the decision, because it not only does it reduce the transportation cost, but it frees up additional courtroom space in the new court building, which was the big issue that we spent so much time about anyway. So the result is good. I'm just not clear that we ever had that clear-cut policy decision, and maybe I'm wrong. And the minutes and the records will certainly...
The discussion we had last time, that's how we took it.
Did we make that kind of firm decision?
We left that discussion up that way.
I think the point was we would go back and study the option of looking at the old court building. And I guess what I'm saying, we're coming back and saying we've gone to Tucson, we've looked at the option, and here we are telling you, okay, Here's what that option is.
Putting this bond forward presupposes that decision is, so maybe we're running both decisions at the same time, and I understand that.
Yeah, and I apologize, Tom, and maybe one of the things I want to be clear of, we're presenting to the council, I'm not even sure everything you see here in front of you and everything you see in front of transportation that we can do.
Right, I understand.
We want to put everything on the table, though, to say, here's some other things we've identified as needs.
Right, I'm fine.
Mayor and Council, if I may, maybe I can help here a little bit on this issue. Back when we did the original planning for the new court building, this option was not on the table. The prospect of possibly using the existing court building was not on the table for an arraignment center or any other purpose. The chief at the time had other plans for that building. The idea came up, it was discussed, but it was not a road that we could have went down at the time because it was anticipated the current court building would be used for other purposes. So that forced us into a situation of looking at what possibly we could do in an interim period to help with the jail situation. So the decision was, let's try to create some capacity in the new court building to help with the arrest and the numbers that we might see over the next few years until a solution came forward for arraignments and the arrest situation. So the idea of putting the custody operation and holding in the new court building was, the intent was to give us some capacity to help with the jail situation and to buy us some time over a few years until we could come to a solution. It's at this time that the idea of the arraignment center and the existing court building came back, and so we're revisiting it.
And is the court, you and the presiding judge, in favor of this arraignment center?
We have supported the concept of arraignment center all along, even going back prior to the new court building. The key is it has to be fully resourced, so you've got to have your prosecutors there and public defenders. Yeah. And bear in mind, I think the chief raises a very valid public safety issue. You really need to be able to arrest all those that should be arrested, and we have that issue now.
As I said, Chief and Chris, I think the concept is a good one. I just don't remember the council having made that. And hopefully the next time this comes up, you all can remind me that we did this on September 13th, and I won't have forgotten again. But I think this is a much more definitive discussion on this is where we're going than we had before. So I'm perfectly comfortable with it.
And maybe, Council, these are the possibilities. Maybe the better way to couch this is we've now gone back, as we, when we talked to council, we've come up with what we think may be another solution. As I recall, I think, Paul, you were mentioning, I think the old court building at one point had been talked about, we were going to move the detectives to that location.
Yeah,
and then we've now, with but Chief Gascon has, from his perspective, administratively decided they would be better served to be out in the field and working there, I think.
Yeah, and I'm prepared to discuss that. I think probably some of the issues several years ago when the courthouse issue came up in front of you was that we had a highly centralized model of policing where all detectives were centralized. Therefore, the idea was to take the old court or the existing court building, and that would become basically a detective center. Since then, we have moved a significant portion of our detectives into the field because that is really where they should be in the first place, working with patrol personnel. We're still going to have a core of detectives that are going to be centralized because some of the functions that they play, at least for the next 10 or 20 years in a city of the size of Mesa, would make sense to be centralized. And the plan actually is to take the other two floors that we have in that building. The top floor would be we would have some of our centralized detective functions like our major narcotics, our homicide, and our financial crimes unit, which are still centralized. They will also occupy a portion of the first floor, and the rest of the first floor would have a combination of community meeting rooms, and they would have a comp staff room that would be equipped not only to be used by the police department, but to be used by any other city entity that, you know, as you develop Mesa Stat or City Stat, that you will also have a room that is a multi-purpose meeting room that will be accessible to the public. We would then take the existing building that we have by the 60 and Country Club, which is really a warehouse, and turn that into a facility to hold evidence. We're running out of space to hold evidence. We're having a lot of difficulties maintaining evidence and meeting all the requirements, both in order to meet trial and court requirements, as well as state issues. And that is a continuing growth problem, because obviously as we arrest more people and as we involve more cases, we're going to continue to have a storage problem. The current facility where we have detectives today really wasn't designed for people. It's being made use for people, but it would be an ideal place to hold evidence and certain vehicles that are involving asset forfeiture, that are high-dollar vehicles that really need to be kept under roof as opposed to in an open storage facility. So the goal would be to take the folks that are there, move them into the existing court building, have the arraignment center on the basement with additional detention capabilities or holding facilities, have the first floor, which would be a combination of public setting for public meetings, as well as Comstead and the ability for other city departments to use that facility. That is one of the reasons why, for instance, when we're talking about the Dobson Station and looking at the future growth and why the Dobson Station is so inadequate today, because it was designed as a substation. And I really like to start removing the term substation from our community stations, because they're really intended to be a full-service police facility. Having detectives in the stations has created additional strain in our current facilities because they were not designed to hold that kind of personnel level. Clearly, Dobson is the more strain out of all, because it is the station that has the one of the smallest ones, and is one that is servicing an area that has a great need for police services.
Love you.
Thank you. Tom, I don't recall the discussion either, so I'm having senior moments, but I am very comfortable with the model. And I do recall the discussion about the use, but just not anything close to discussing this model. But I think that this is a good answer. The additional detention aspects of it, I think, are really positive. You know, we're all familiar with those broken taillight turned out to be the kidnapper, or, you know, and the shoplifter turns out to be the guy who's out there shooting people randomly. And so I think that if we can get more people fingerprinted, more people booked, doing all of those things, we can possibly do those things that you were talking about. But our jailing costs, would you remind me, Chief, this last year, in terms of jailing costs, if we go to the county, how much it's costing
sure.
us?
We're anticipating that there will be roughly about $5 million for this current fiscal year. The cost now is $189 for the first day, and it's $72 for every day thereafter. and that is any misdemeanor suspect. In fact, if we get someone that gets sentenced through the city courts to do, say, 6 months in jail, 3 months, or a year, we have to pay that for those folks. And that is something that I'd like to, at the tail end of this discussion, actually, to have another discussion, because the cost of holding people in county jail is becoming very, very expensive. And we're also having other problems. For instance, in the case of the DUIs that are sent by the city court, they have to take medical clearances, so they have to go to a doctor. If they don't have a medical clearance, they would not be accepted. You know, most other jails around the country have a dispensary, have their own doctors. In essence, if you can have a doctor say that your blood pressure is too high or that you're too ill to be in jail, you don't get to go to jail.
Or if your name is Paris Hilton. Well,
if you have a lot of money, we do have a specialty jail in this county too, by the way. Don't be fooled by Paris Hilton.
Chief, would you say again what the first day cost is?
The first day is $189.
It's up to $189?
Correct. And then there are $72 a day.
$72. And I was just meeting on my Community and Economic Development Steering Committee. I started polling people, you know, as we're offline not discussing economic development. They're being charged in major cities around the country. They're being charged between $40 and $45 a day for their jailing costs, and some of them are contracting with jails in other parts of the state. Right. So our number is very high, and I like your idea here of the additional detention. I think that this arraignment center is the right way to go. Let's make it really clear, though, that one thing that was being said there that I thought, oh, the public's going to hear that and they're going to go crazy, is we're going to bring in drinks and sandwiches for people. You know, I'm assuming that's green bologna. And
well, you know, it's important. I mean, currently,
yeah,
I mean,
IOTV.
we're supposed to provide subsistence when people are in custody.
Yeah.
So what we're talking about is that if they are, it's much cheaper to allow the pit configuration where people are able to move around and sort of self-service and self. Clearly, there's going to be some people who are not going to fit that model. But what we saw in the Pima County model is that actually, when people realize that you have an option, you can be locked up or you can have a little freedom, they actually exercise the decision to behave and be more social, socially acceptable behavior, and that actually reduces our cost of maintaining those people while we're processing them.
I agree. I just didn't want it to sound like somehow we were opening the country club. That was my point.
Not at all. We're meeting basic custody requirements that we have to meet.
I think it's very, very smart and rational, and it sounds good to me. Thank you.
Mayor, just real quickly, Paul, this is because another point that the Vice Mayor brought up. I was in the meeting with the judges the other day, and you were talking about the number of people who don't show up.
That's
court.
Right.
What was that number again? Because I think that's a pretty surprising number, that if we had the arraignment court, we wouldn't have to have all this warrant.
Sure. What takes place is because they're not able to arrest those that probably should be arrested, they must be cited, and they're scheduled to appear at a regular arraignment at the court. And I think our rate of no-shows is running about 25% or 30%. And some of the cases we see, we can see that from the paperwork that they probably should have been arrested from the get-go. So that's, you're correct, Chris. That's another problem.
Okay, Mike.
Real quick, does this, George, require then the moving of the crime lab into the evidence building? We were going to use some portion of the basement to continue with the crime lab, or does that move?
The crime lab will continue to be the way it's set up. And, you know, obviously they have the new building that is
coming. You've got a courtroom down there plus some old detention facilities, and that's what you'd use?
Correct, yes.
Just a matter of history, the neighborhood is historic, and a lot of work will have to be done with that area to make sure that they're comfortable with this proposal.
Yeah.
Having been through that, it's something that needs great attention.
And we'll certainly do so, and Council Member Whaling. And the other part, I think it bears repeating, this model actually should reduce the need for lockup facilities, because you're getting people in and out fairly quickly. So it's not like we're increasing the number of beds that are going to be people staying overnight. To the contrary will be the case. People will be processed in and out hopefully very quickly, assuming that we can get the right staffing levels for the courts and the prosecution and the public defender.
Okay, let's go ahead and proceed through the
slide. The next item is it has to do with, well, and then you can see the cost there. We're looking at around $16 million will be the capital cost to bring that building to the standards that will be required. Again, those numbers were provided by engineering, and we're looking at an O&M cost of approximately $2.7 million per year. The next item has to do with police aviation. We have a couple of rotor aircrafts that are reaching their life expectancy. One has about 17,000 hours. The other one has about 14,000 hours. We're still exploring whether a hybrid aviation configuration between fixed and rotor wing is something that can be worked. And that's the reason why, rather than saying helicopters, we're saying police aviation. Also, there are other models that are being explored as a possibility of a regional agreement with other cities. But nevertheless, it is important to recognize that we need to put some money aside for this aspect of our operations. And if we find a way to do it for less and do it more efficiently, we certainly will. Second item here, or the third item here, has to do with the our Center Against Family Violence, and this is one of those areas that was a PERF recommendation. If you recall, in the PERF study, one of the areas that they raised is the concern about the safety of that facility, especially at nighttime. We have police employees, we have nurses and people that come in, and because it is not a fence facility, it's not well secure, we have times where we've had individuals roaming around the facility. We've had people sleeping under the stairwells. And so it concerns us as far as the safety of that particular facility, how it's currently structured. And the recommendation there, which is one that we agree with, is to fence the facility and provide a more secure location. And then I believe that we get into police capital training. This is range improvements. I like to have, we have our academy personnel here, so if I can have Dave, you want to
Mark. Okay, the next item is for our shooting range. Two issues we have there. We have an old trailer that we've been using since, I think, for
1970,
that's what I thought. and it says it has a maximum capacity of 20 participants, classroom size. That's stretching it. I mean, it really is more comfortable with 15 to 18. Now, our academy classes go through there, so if we have 40 to 50 people in an academy class to go out to the range, we can't put them all in a classroom. So what we want to do is build a classroom that can handle an academy class. We use that facility for use of force training during our shoots. We have classroom training usually with every firearm shoot that we do. So we have a very desperate need to increase the size of that capacity for our classroom. And then the other part is for a shade over the range. I think we have a great opportunity to keep this range for, with the freeway, it has really buffered the noise issues that we've had with the neighborhood over the years, and that neighborhood has changed over the years. When we used to have noise complaints, so it's, I think, ideally located. We like to keep it, and having some shade would make it a lot more useful for our people up through the course of the year. That total is just over $1 million.
The problem that we have, obviously, especially during the summer month, we're having a real safety issue because it gets very, very warm out there, and we're trying to operate out of that range and that black tarred, and we just don't have enough shade. We're concerned, especially with our range personnel, issues like skin cancer and heat exhaustion, as well as the people that are actually going through the training. So, again, this is not something extravagant. It's really basic needs that need to be attended to that, quite frankly, should have been attended to a long time ago. That brings our total in the capital improvement size for the range facility to about a $1 million and the OMN cost to $82,000. Moving to the next page, If we look at the total police capital improvements, and again, as was indicated by Mr. Brady, these are just points of discussions and recommendations. It would be clearly up to you to decide what or, you know, how you want to configure this. But as currently proposed, you're looking at roughly about a total of approximately $13.5 million for the Dobson Station with an O&M cost of $70,000 a year. Approximately 16.4 for the arraignment center with an OMA cost of about 2.7, and that of course would be handling the court needs, the prosecution, the public defenders, aviation at around $4.5 million, family center against family violence at right around $384,000 with about the $5,000 OMA cost, range improvements at about $1 million with an $82,000 OMA for a total of roughly $36 million with an OMA cost of approximately $3 million a year. Another area that I like to discuss very briefly is looking at the additional improvements and projects for council consideration having to do with the growth and the needs for the police department. And first of all, I'd like to say that I would strongly like to recommend that we actually hire a consulting group to come in and do some master planning analysis for public safety for the next 10 and 20 years in the city. I think it will be really important for people that do this for a living to look at best practices around the country, project where the city is going in the future, and give us an assessment as to what our needs are likely to be. But certainly the needs, as we can tell today, is that we're going to have to increase our footprint of police presence and facilities on the east side of the city. And definitely we're going to have to look at future holding facilities on the east side. Another thing that is not on the slide that I'd like to point out also is that I think that we really have, again, and we need experts to look at this for us, to look at the jailing cost and the future jailingness of the city and possibly regionally, and see whether the model that we're currently using is the right model or whether there would be other models that could present better opportunities, not only for Mesa perhaps, but for the region. The escalating cost of holding people in jails, if it continues at the rate that it has been for the last 10 years, it's already reaching a point of prohibitiveness, given the fact that we can't afford, quite frankly, to hold the people that we should be holding, and there is no sign that this will be abating anytime soon. Also, we have to consider that we're spending increasingly more time on the road traveling to take people to jail, and that is significant time that is being taken from the police officer's time. And even if you create a transportation process where you use civilians to transport people, you're still going to have times when officers just cannot wait. You're going to have the unruly suspect. The suspect is going to have to take into jail. And our people right now are spending 2 and 3 hours when they have to travel to Phoenix in order to book somebody at a county jail. That is extremely expensive when you look at the personnel cost that you tied up when you tied up officers for that long period of time. The other thing, too, and I know that it's an area that we may not control, but nevertheless, I think it needs to be brought out to the public dialogue. This can no longer continue to be a Phoenix-centric region. We need to have county courthouses that are located within the Mesa City borders. Again, we, the taxpayers of the cities, are paying a great deal of money that is being wasted in public safety money for officers to go to Phoenix to sit around and wait for court time. And we have to recognize that it's only going to get worse. It's not going to get any better. And the time to start looking at these issues is today. So I believe that hiring a professional firm that can look at all these issues and, you know, a third party, unbiased, it's not the cops talking about it, or somebody that can look around best practices around the country and lay out a proposed master plan for public safety concerning the policing side of it, I think it will be really money well spent, and I think it would be something that would, I think future generations would appreciate that kind of thoughtful process from this council and certainly all of us.
Okay. Thanks, Chief. Fire Department?
Mayor, members of the council, as you know, Fire Department's been very active within the last several months, doing quite a bit of education on the issues that we're going to be talking about here again today. So we'll try to be brief. We'll try not to repeat ourselves too much. I think you're fairly familiar with most of these issues. As the police department and all departments in the city, we're faced with some unbelievable growth challenges, not to mention that we're simply a little behind in several other areas. So the catch-up situation is going to be very difficult for us. In setting our priorities and taking a look at the fire department needs, it's pretty clear that the first need that we need to bring to you is the acquisition of additional fire apparatus. We're currently five of our current units are beyond the time frame and the life expectancy for these types of units. But our superior maintenance group has been able to keep them on the road. We're concerned that much longer we're going to begin to see maintenance problems or breakdowns that could be detrimental to emergency response. And as I've mentioned before, these are more than just fire trucks. These are life support systems for firefighters inside of buildings. And a failure is really just not acceptable. So it's very important for us to maintain our fleet to be in absolutely confident working order. We'll go to the next slide. You've seen this before. Again, this is our strategic plan for station placement. For those who are not familiar with this chart, the diamonds that are in there, first of all, the diamonds illustrate about a four-minute response time zone for each of the fire stations. The items that are in yellow are areas that the city currently owns property for fire stations, and the areas that are in gray are where we have forecasted the need for additional property for fire stations. We have both problems in the city of Mesa. We have the infill problem, where we have high call volumes here on the west side, and we have obviously the massive growth situation on the east side. Both impact our response times, and we know that fire station placement and our ability to deploy the appropriate unit in the appropriate facility gives us the best possibility of improving our response times. At the same time, several of the current stations that we're going to continue to man are somewhat inadequate. They need a refurbishing, they need some room additions, and things of that nature. So we'll be covering all of that as we go through the rest of this presentation. As was mentioned before, we're requesting the construction of three new and one replacement fire station. The replacement fire station there is Station 3. It's been around since 1957. I believe that's accurate. Somewhere in the late 50s. And is really to the point where it's not functional as a fire station any longer. It doesn't meet a lot of the safety standards. And it's clearly just very difficult for the staff to operate out of that facility. The three new fire stations, one would be for the engine 218 that is currently in service without a station, and the other two would be new stations, would be for new areas of the city that are currently unserved. The total capital cost for fire station request is almost $15 million, and the first year O&M on each of those, well, the total O&M for those would be a little over $3 million a year. Can I just interject here? I just wanted to point out this is for two stations, the $3 million operating cost. One is quality of life supported, as the chief has mentioned, from 218, and the other is the replacement. So this is representing two stations.
I thought you could do a station for $1 million a year. Now it's $1.5 million.
This is now inflated down into the periods of which it would be applicable, and I'd have to go back and look at the cash flows, Mayor. But
4 or 5 years.
Yes.
Okay.
Again, as I mentioned, it's Station 203 is our oldest station, and I did guess right on the year. It was built originally in 1957, and the cost for replacing that station is going to be about $4.8 million. Item 12 is to acquire land for future fire stations. As I mentioned before, we do have several locations that have already been purchased. It's kind of ironic that those were not purchased in the areas where we have the most significant need. So we really are in a position where we need an additional four sites. Not only are they in critical areas of the city, but they're also part of that would complete what we have anticipated in our strategic plan as a build-out plan for fire station properties.
Vice Mayor.
Sorry, need to take you back for a second. You said the replacement of fire station 203 would be 4.8. It says total capital cost, so I had assumed that that included the construction of three new and one replacement. That's just one is the 4.8? That's just replacement of fire station 203?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And let me, while I've got the floor, just let me ask one other question. When you renovate a fire station, if you look at your capital improvements projects for public safety, you go down to item 15, it says renovate stations 205, 209, 210, 213, and 214. What creates the additional O&M costs of about, you know, about $100,000 a year for additional O&M when you aren't adding new personnel?
Primarily, and I'll jump in for you, Chief. That's the utilities, custodial, landscaping, and the telephones for the larger building. And they've got some new systems that are included in those buildings, such as evacuation of diesel fumes and those kind of things.
Yeah, Chief, talk about it, because I know it's a big issue in fire departments now, is that exhaust.
It really is.
What it was
called. We're skipping ahead a little bit, but that's okay.
Sorry.
We have several of our stations were built with the storage lockers for the firefighting equipment right on the apparatus bay, which made sense. That's in close proximity to the fire truck. It's easy to store. But what we have learned through the last 7 or 8 years, probably 10 years now, is that as we drive diesel trucks in and out of that apparatus bay, it blows the exhaust onto the clothing that they wear for firefighting. What that does is that saturates them with combustible particles, if you will, unburned parts of diesel fuel. And so it makes those protective clothing less protective. So we're in a position where we're continually trying to keep them clean. So what we need to do is relocate those. And as you can imagine, when you have 12 or 13 people at the station per unit, that's a sizable area where you need to develop locker storage. That's off and away from the apparatus floor. So that's a good question. I'd like to just make a few more comments on the acquisition of land for fire stations. I think the city council has been very prudent in purchasing land for fire stations well in advance of the need to locate, to actually construct the fire station. The property values are escalating at an unbelievable rate, and although they seem expensive at the time, we certainly are saving a lot of money. We have one location that we found, that we purchased, that we found is not in the ideal location. We're attempting to sell almost three times the value that we had initially invested to make the original purchase. So it's quite a very good plan. And the sites where we need most right now is a site for Station 203. That lot that the current station on is inadequate for a new facility. We're also looking at 56th and Main, which is a location where we desperately need. And it's a growing area, believe it or not. It's kind of a central location, but it's a growing area. And then two sites in East Mesa. The total capital for acquisition of land is about $4.8 million.
Scott?
Chief, are we working with DMB on, I know it's very, very early, but having some discussions with them about donating the land on the GM Proving Ground, because that, excuse me, that area is going to require at least two, possibly three fire stations, I would guess. We had those discussions about what they're willing to do too early.
Council members, I have had that conversation through Amy Morales in that development group and working with the consulting firm that's looking at the total planning for the Gateway area. And we have discussed the opportunity to have discussions with the developer about a donation or at least reserving fire station sites in that development. And so those discussions are ongoing.
And that has worked in other communities as well, where the large developers, not the smaller home builders, or where even large builders that are doing smaller developments, but large builders and major planned communities like this have set aside land for fire and police stations, the capital projects. This is nothing new.
Correct.
But we're gonna try to apply that here in this area. And I'm looking at the map, looks like two sites, so. Okay, thank you.
It's not uncommon for the cities and developers to work together to site fire stations as a part of the development. Makes a lot of sense.
I mean, that's a good discussion to be having. That'll save the taxpayers some significant dollars and help establish some locations for valuable infrastructure, public safety infrastructure in the future. I want to just make sure we're having those conversations. Thanks.
Okay.
The next item is the Fire Operations Center. As you know, that item was included in the previous bond. Essentially, what happened is the price of building the fire administration building ran away from the allotment that was provided for in the bond. And so we have used those dollars to purchase some fire trucks and do some other essential things that we've needed in the meantime. So we're still at a point where fire administration is decentralized into four different locations. It really makes it difficult for coordination with the staff and communication issues. A city of our size needs a fire administration home. As you know, we currently are leasing space at about $15,000 a month or $180,000 a year, which is not coming back to us in any way, shape, or form. So I think it's extremely critical that we make the commitment to build a fire operations center to where we can begin to appreciate the efficiencies of having the administration staff at least under the same roof. And the total capital cost of that item is a little over $14 million. And the first full year of O&M is $141,000. The next item is our obstacle preemption. One of the technology advances that we've implemented, I think, with a very good vision, because it certainly has a direct impact on our response times. As you might recall, these devices change the traffic lights to green when fire apparatus are en route, to help speed up the response time as well as avoid any accidents of a sudden fire truck entering in an intersection. So it's a great program. This particular item is requested to be funded at just under $1 million, and it would allow us to reach 66% of the intersections with traffic preemption at that time. And the ongoing O&M for that is a little over about $25,000. As we mentioned earlier, the renovation of fire stations, we have several fire stations that are dated. Again, many of the items that we need to build into these stations are things that weren't foreseen at the time of the original construction. But in addition to that, simply growth is required. The other thing is when we have small fire stations, it really limits us in terms of the flexibility we need for deployment. As you know, we've implemented a new unit for the first time this past several months. And we're looking at doing a lot more innovative types of things with moving units around and reconfigurations and things of that nature. But the bottom line is that we will find limitations to that because of space availability. And having apparatus bays is, I think, always a good plan. To have larger stations is always a good plan. So any way that we can refurbish these fire stations, I think, helps us stay ahead of the curve. As you can imagine, these fire stations will be looked at in the future for potential replacement or relocation, depending on the way that the service demand models begin to lay out for us.
Tom, if I can interrupt you, yes. Why would there be $400,000 in O&M for renovation?
Due to the increased sizes and the increased systems that weren't in the original buildings. It's based on the per square footage, and that's how we've determined the cost. It's not additional staffing. It's based on the requirements of the additional square footage and those additional systems.
Utilities and things like
yes.
that?
Yes, additional utilities, the telephone cost, custodial, the landscape maintenance. So some of the sites were extremely small. Now that you'll have the more standard size, there's additional cost with it.
Okay. And have we calculated how much additional community rooms add to this cost?
I'm sure we could probably break that component back
out. I'd like to see that broken out again. Not adverse to community rooms, but that part of these facilities don't add to the public safety. They're just nice to have, and I understand that. So I'd like to see how much those are for each one of these to be included.
That, and Mayor, Councilman Falls, and maybe the idea too is maybe not every station needs to have them too. It could be.
Well, it would depend upon the additional cost.
But we can break that out.
Right, I'd like to see that. Thank you.
The pictures on this slide are pretty indicative of the conditions that we're working with. And the picture on the left is basically an attachment to Station 5 just to have enough space to function there. pretty inefficient in terms of not only the space that's in there, but also just the operation of that type of construction. It requires much more maintenance, where our permanent structures are generally, at least on the outside, low cost for maintenance. And then the picture on the right is the picture that I mentioned earlier about the apparatus bays being open where the protective clothing are stored, and we have the contamination problems there. Again, some of the key things we're looking for with the remodels is to improve our infectious control and decontamination. As you would imagine, after messy first aid calls, EMS calls, it's necessary to clean up equipment. That's there's infectious disease control issues with regard to biological waste that many of our fire stations don't have an organized way to manage that. It's really not possible. It's really not appropriate to flush that sort of debris down normal sewer pipes or to leave it in the front yard after you hose something off. I mean, I hate to get too descriptive, but it's an essential need for us. Again, we talked about the diesel exhaust, the turnout storage. Not only will we relocate the turnouts, but we'll also put in exhaust systems for the diesel fumes that build up in the apparatus space. Over the years, there's been studies done on the essentially the quality of the air in those apparatus bays after fire trucks have been running in and out of them, and they tend to, with the high ceilings, they tend to collect those vapors. So these exhaust systems are actually required now as a minimum standard, and we have them in all of our new fire stations. So it's something that we think is pretty important for safety that we think we need to add as well. The picture there also shows a dormitory that has been partially converted to an office for battalion safety officer. So again, it's a feature of the growth and demand that we have, the issues that we have to deal with without the adequate space, and it limits our ability to deploy in a way that makes the most sense for our system. The total cost for the renovations is just a little over $3 million, and the full year O&M on those would be about $400,000. Item 16 is the public safety training facility, special operations and fire suppression props. Again, that facility was built in 1986. The current inventory is pretty old and very difficult to maintain. Once they're used up, they begin to deteriorate rather quickly, and there's not much you can do about it. You might recall a couple years ago we had to rebuild our what we call our smokehouse, or the building that we use to build fires to train firefighters. They simply come apart under extreme heat over a period of time, and it's the same with all the props that we use out there. We need to do something for our vertical ventilation. As you know, firefighters will cut holes in roofs to vent gases. We need to drill and train on that in an area that's safe. Those props help us do that. And you can see other examples there for confined space, building collapse, and flammable liquid drills and things of that nature. We're in the process of coordinating with the police department to hopefully provide a tour to as many council members who would like to do that, to go out and just sort of take a look at that facility and see what is going on there. You would be amazed at the amount of activity that's going on there on a daily basis. And many times it even extends into the evenings with extra use from different people. So hopefully we can make that happen here in a short period of time. So in summary, for fire department requests, a little over $14 million for additional fire apparatus, or replacement fire apparatus, I should say. Almost $20 million for the construction of three new and one replacement fire station. Acquire four future fire station locations. An operations center, administration center for the fire department. The continuation of our obstacle preemption program. And then some very critical renovations that we need for several of our fire stations. And then the public safety training facility, as I just mentioned. So the total capital improvement project request from fire is almost $58 million. It's rather meager. And a total first-year O&M for all those improvements would be approximately $3.6 million. Additional items that we'd like to talk about briefly is, and we've brought this to council before, and it's in and through the public safety committee. the fire air replenishment system for the Mesa Plaza, City Plaza building. It's basically the system that allows firefighters to refill air on upper floors. It's one of the features that's going to be required for high-rise buildings here in the future. And we're really interested in looking at trying to make that happen in all of the existing high-rise buildings as well. We know how difficult that will be, but we also know that without that sort of a replenishment system that when you consider firefighters' air supplies last with exertion anywhere from 15 to 20 minutes, and that's highly fit people, if you think about having to go into a high-rise building and go up three floors and initiate any sort of firefighting operation, it's not very long before you're out of air and you have to come back down and refill. So it's one of those things that really makes us effective in fighting fires in high-rise buildings. It's anything less is pretty dysfunctional. So we do the best we can with it as it's currently designed, but these replenishment systems are pretty essential. Also, in the event that somebody should inadvertently run out of air, it gives us the ability to get them to an air supply very quickly. They'll be in standard locations. Then maintenance, the expansion of our fire maintenance resource expansion warehouse. As you know, our fleet's growing. We have an ongoing need for fleet maintenance, not to mention the fact that once you increase the number of fire stations, you're going to have much more warehouse requirement and much more interaction there with the warehouse. Then a renovation to Station 208. Again, an indication that even with the potential of council approving this package and that the voters approving it in the election, that we will still be in very much a catch-up mode with regard to fire service. We have slipped seriously behind our response time goals, and when you look at the full scope of the issues that have impacted that, it's going to take us many years to catch up and get back to where we were as little as 3 or 4 years ago. So additional fire stations and renovations are going to continue to be an issue. And then the last item that we would like to do at some point is, several years ago we had a 10-year plan for development of the fire training facility. That plan's probably 12 or 13 years old, and we're not even close to bringing it up to where we had originally planned. And the original plan is very valid. We review it every year to be sure that we're still on track. The priorities change out there, but the bottom line stays the same. We still need a full service training facility. So we have ideas for phase improvements out there if council's willing to discuss those any further. So a summary. Chuck, are you going to do the summary? Okay. If you didn't have any more questions for the chief, I'll try to wrap this up for you. Just to give you the broad spectrum, we had about $78 million in costs for the joint projects with $1.3 million in O&M. Police capital projects of about $36 million with just under $3 million in O&M cost. Fire capital projects about $58 million with $3.7 million in cost, for a total package of just about $172 million and $7.9 million in O&M cost. What our intention is to do is, this was our best effort to present a scrub down list, identifying all the costs. What we will do is, based on your discussions, is come back and try to put these into cash flows so that you can see what the impacts are in their fiscal year based on whatever packages you wanted to include. I wanted to also point out, in that additional package, if you needed information along with that summary, there's a profile on every one of the projects with a project timeline so that you can see approximately where it would drop in and what the inflated costs are. So with that, I'll turn it over to the council.
So I would anticipate, 20-year bonding program? Is that what you're...
Yes, sir.
And the they've got... can't do the numbers in my head, but how much per year if you did a level and then the operations and...
Mayor, we'll come back on all that discussion. All right. We weren't really prepared to kind of get into that, but some of those discussions need to happen. But we want to also bring in the context of transportation. I think the challenge for us, too, is the continuing dialogue of how do we deal with not only the CIP costs, but the O&M costs, and how will that be addressed. And so we can give you some rules of thumb on $1 million is equal to, what is the number? Do you know?
Well, I want to run everything with whatever our current projected debt service rates are and so forth. We're currently, just to give you perspective, we're working on your forecast for this fall. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to get caught on a number today that I want to be changing here in the next month or so.
Okay. Look forward to that. Any questions? All right. Thank you very much. The next item is appointments to boards or committees.
Move for approval.
Scott.
Mayor, once again, thank you for appointing two members from District 6.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Passes. Number 5, hear reports on meetings and or conferences attended. Any updates?
We delay this.
Yeah,
thank you.
Scheduling and meetings and general information, Mr. Brady.
Just quickly, we have an Audit and Finance Committee meeting following this meeting, and we'll have our council's meeting on Monday, September 17th, and followed by study sessions on the 20th and 27th. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions? All right. Are there any requests to speak? Any items?
No citizens, Mayor.
All right. Then I would ask for a motion to adjourn the study session.
So moved.
All right. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All right. And then I need a motion to
so moved.
Enter into an executive session for a special council meeting. Or call a special council meeting to order for the purposes of convening an executive session.
So moved.
Have a motion. Second.
Ties for a second.
Through a second.
No, Mike said second.
Second. Okay. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Okay. Thank you very much. We're in executive session.